Speed Muddle on Saturday, July 8th at the Palace of Auburn Hills. It's going to be awesome.
And now, a Comcast Consumer Bulletin.
This just in. If you're an SBC customer in Michigan, Wisconsin, or Arkansas, your average SBC home phone rates are the highest in the nation.
What? SBC charges us more than states like California and Texas? Come on, SBC, give Michigan a break.
In fact, we pay on average 40% more for SBC service than California does. 40%.
What choice does a Michigan SBC customer have?
It's easy. Switch to Comcast Digital Voice home phone service and save up to 25% on your phone bill. For one low price, you can have unlimited local and long distance service, 12 popular calling features, and even web access to voicemail.
So hang up on SBC and get better phone service than the phone company with Comcast Digital Voice. Just call 1-888-COMCAST.
This has been a Comcast Consumer Bulletin. Service not available in all areas. Restrictions may apply. Phone rate comparison for SBC based on FCC published reference book on rates updated March 2006 by West Virginia Public Service Commission. Price comparison based on SBC's unlimited package as described on website as of 9/19/05.
Welcome to the award-winning Night Call, the Riff's phone-in talk show on 101 WRIF Detroit. Our number, 313-298-WRIF. Now, here's the host of Night Call, Peter Werby.
Well, thank you very much. Welcome to the broadcast. And yeah, write that number down, 313-298-WRIF. If you'd like to email me, short ones, please, if you have any idea that I'll read them on the air, I'll try to do it, but they got to be short. If they're longer ones, you really want to express yourself, you can do that too, but I won't read them probably till tomorrow morning. And that's calltalkyes@yahoo.com. Calltalkyes@yahoo.com. One thing, actually, most of you have been pretty good about this, and maybe the ones that haven't probably have never heard me say this before. Don't put me on this list. Some of you, I mean, I don't, you know, I get stuff from you like at 8 a.m., then at 3 p.m., then at 7 p.m. Are you really on there for like 8 or 10 hours just browsing the internet for more proof? It's beautiful days. At least that's actually everywhere in the United States, probably everywhere almost in the world now, there's good weather. So get outside, turn the computer off, and take a little walk in the sunshine. I get trapped in it too. You go, whoa, I didn't know that. And then it leads you somewhere else. But one of the things that I don't need is I don't need forewords from Yahoo News or from the New York Times or stuff like that. Cause I look at that too. If you have stuff, so that's what I mean. Don't just automatically send me, everything you send everyone else. Some people, like I said, I get 5 and 6 emails a day and every one of them are just front and center in every news site on the web. So, in fact, I'm kind of wondering, who are you sending these to that doesn't have this information, or maybe what it is? Here's the deal. There's actually, I won't say her name because she might be listening. She sends me, sometimes 6 a day, like I said. And of those 6, sometimes none of, I mean, I just read the titles. I go, I know that. I mean, that was the lead story. Why am I being sent that? But once in a while, she sends me stuff that's really good. So I don't give her a hard time. I've never written her and say, don't send me so many things. Wait a minute. I got to do something. Yeah. Hey, no, it sounds the same, doesn't it? You know, I've never 100% kicked this cold, and you people are steady getting it back again. I don't have a cold, but it's just sort of that I don't even want to, it's the kind of thing if I say what's happening, you'll say, well, thanks for sharing. I really wanted to know about the interior of your throat. But it's what I call kind of gives me that godfather, when it starts really getting like that. It's not good, I don't want to make any offers. Anyway, oh yeah, talk show here, 313-298-WRIF. I'm sort of treading water here. I'm not even sure for any real reason. It's just everything seems to be crashing down upon us in terms of what's going on in the world. Certainly the oil prices, but maybe I really like cultural stuff lately. All the information is in. Bush's popularity or approval rating is down to 31%. That's even 2% below what I always call the fascist third, that no matter what he did, if he suspended the Constitution and began to rule by administrative fiat, that third, you would think, would usually say, yeah, well, it's okay because, in whatever reason, you know, he had just given on television. But it's even dropping below that. So hopefully, maybe there isn't a fascist third in this country. Maybe it's only like 20%. So we'll see. Maybe Bush's popularity will drop that far. But what all the information is out there. There's a colleague of mine that's a nationally syndicated talk show host, Mike Malloy. Check him out, MikeMalloy.com. And when people call in and challenge him, I mean, I would never do this. You call in, 313-298-WRIF. But when he call in and they say, well, you tell me how, he says, I'm not going to do your work for you. Go to the internet. It's all there. I don't have to make these arguments for you. I don't have to prove my point. So I think about 70% of the population, all the information is in about this corrupt regime that's ruling us on behalf of these corporations. And the only thing most of us are waiting for is what awful thing is going to happen next. What are they going to screw up next? What lie is going to be exposed? How deep is the corruption going to go into the CIA head that just resigned and what have you, and how many congressmen are going to be indicted? It's going to be so sweet if the Democrats get at least one House of Congress this fall. And, you know, I'm not a big fan of the Democrats or anything like that, but they will have subpoena power, and they can start doing investigations into this multitude of corruption and lies and alterations of the Constitution by the executive branch that they couldn't before. So that alone probably is worth seeing them and get one of the houses at least. But both houses, well, then maybe Bush would start using vetoes. He doesn't use vetoes now. He just signs everything and then says he's going to ignore laws. Maybe, you know, the last time I read the Constitution, it said the duty of the executive branch was to faithfully execute the laws that Congress passes. Bush has, and I'll get back to this a little later, Bush has declared that there are 750 laws that he will not follow. 750, I mean, he says this. These are called, what are they called? Signing statements. Isn't that what it is? So he'll say, yeah, okay, sure. No, we're signing another law that forbids the United States from being a torture state like it is, just like any other horrid torture regime throughout the world. And so Bush says, I'm not following. You know, he says, okay, I'll sign this. Okay, can't torture anybody. And then he signs this little statement saying, after everyone's gone home, I don't have to follow this. Anyways, all the information is there, and if you still got to be convinced about the war in Iraq or how the economy benefits the wealthy or the environment's going to hell and the middle class is being eroded, working class standards of living are dropping, the wiretapping is illegal, all that stuff. If you still need to be convinced of that, go to the internet, all right, because all the information is there and all the arguments are there. So a lot of it now just becomes in the cultural arena. The cultural arena. So you have like this brand new Neil Young album, Living with War, or you have what we were playing the other day, the Pink song, Dear Mr. President, or they've brought back this Bright Eyes tune called When the President Speaks to God. I don't know why I didn't record that. It's on my site. Peter Werbe, PETERWERBE, PeterWerbe.com. Let me see. Oh, yeah. Played the Pink song, Pink and the Indigo Girls. That's really a moving song. That's on my site as well. And there's a bunch of songs there. Here, this is Lonnie writing in from Tokyo. You know, like that's in Japan. And he said, just found Pink's song on your page. Thanks so much for posting the link. It brings up a lot of emotion, tears, and righteous indignation. It is a powerful performance. It really is. I mean, most of us in WRIF are used to, you know, rock. If it rocks, it's on the riff. And this certainly isn't in that genre, but it has some, if you're there with it, which I am, it has extraordinary power. Lonnie in Tokyo is right. And he writes, let's hope it helps fuel the fire of the people. Indeed. So maybe it's just going to be this cultural expression to hold us over. I don't think I want to see a lot more documentaries about the Bush lied and the media lied. Most of us know that by now. Although there's one. What's it called? It's on my site as well. Yes, Sir, No, Sir. And it's about GI rebellions in Vietnam. I definitely want to see that. Anyways, I was leaving my house. My wife, who was watching a couple of, doesn't even talk to me on Sunday night, which is good. I'm preparing for the show in any event. But she watches these two shows. One is called West Wing, and the other is Grey's Anatomy. And so I always see kind of the end. I go up and talk to her, and I go, you know, she's watching the end. I mean, she's watching the whole thing. So I see the end of one, the beginning of another. I've never even seen any of them all the way through. But there were ads on, and there was an ad for The Da Vinci Code, Dan Brown's book, this mega bestseller, even probably beating out some of those Left Behind series, you know, those apocalyptic Armageddon Christian stories that are just these sort of bizarre, I don't know, you know, burning the lake of fire fantasies. But this bestseller beyond belief. When I was in New York last week for that anti-war demonstration, why did I go into Barnes & Noble? But I did. And they've got this whole table because it's come out in paperback. In fact, the Da Vinci Code is now the number one in paper and number 11 still in hardcover, even though you can now get it in paper. And I read it a year and a half or two ago, and I thought it was really a fun read, and it's got a really unusual story, and it is pretty anti, well, I don't know what to say. I mean, it has a little reverential at the end, kind of pulled it up a little, and I tend to bet that they'll, you know, they don't want it, I'm sure the producers in Hollywood don't want it to be this completely anti-Christian movie. Because, I mean, it's okay to have completely pro-Christian movies like The Passion of the Christ. I mean, hey, these people had their turn, so now it's the other side's turn. What are they squawking about? I don't get it. But they are. They're squawking big time. The Vatican wants to sue, or at least one of the cardinals, is Cardinal Francis Arinze, a Nigerian who was even considered a candidate for Pope. But, yeah, since he's from Nigeria, no way. But the Vatican has called for a boycott of the film. Well, banned in Boston. That was an old saying from like the 40s, where if it was banned in Boston, that meant that everyone else went to see it because, ooh, must be pretty racy, right? That's an old term, too. Racy does not have anything to do with race, but kind of sexy, right? Let's see here. What am I reading? Deadline Hollywood Daily. DeadlineHollywoodDaily.com. Says all these attacks are simply generating even more publicity for the already well-hyped film. Perhaps Sony, the producer of the movie, has the Vatican on public relations retainer. And it is sold out in advance in all these Catholic countries like Italy and Spain and Mexico. So it is going to be absolutely enormous. And I don't really have too much to say about it. I'm looking forward to seeing it. I enjoyed the book. As I was reading the book, I said, well, they don't even really need a script writer for this. It's like a script. It's a lot of modern fiction. It doesn't have a lot of the descriptive stuff. It's just all dialogue and plot driven. You know, there's not like a lot of descriptiveness. Because, you know, those novels of the 19th century that we were forced to read in high school and college and early 20th century did a lot with the description. When someone walked through the door, they'd start describing the rug and the wallpaper and chandelier and all that. Well, now it's not. You look the like how many words on a page, very sparse, whereas you look at a 19th century novel, look at it, you know, like Hawthorne or something like that, and it's just solid. So people don't like solid text anyways. But they've got, let's see, they've got all sorts of documentaries out rebutting the Da Vinci Code, saying it's not true. I mean, here's something that has to be believed on faith, right? That A, there is a God, B, he sent a son, you know, that there is an innate nature to humanity that has to be saved by someone sacrificing himself and then being resurrected and all that. So that, it's not like you can logically prove any of that, so you got to take it on faith. So the church rebutting it is kind of weird. Seeing the latest Vatican broadside against the Da Vinci Code, a leading cardinal says Christians should respond to the book and film with legal action because both offend Christ and the church he founded. T.S. Yeah, I mean, you don't like it, don't go see it. Yeah. Found the whole idea of the Passion of the Christ kind of offensive. Didn't occur to me to go sue anybody. So 40 million copies, and they've got illustrated editions now. In this Barnes & Noble, they had this table, and they probably had... They had a little pocketbook, and then they had a big trade, what do they call it? Trade paperback, bigger one. Then they had the illustrated version, and of course, all of his Dan Brown's other books, or is there only one? I don't know. And the central tenet of the book, I hope I'm not giving anything away, it's pretty, that Jesus did not die on the cross, but in fact married Mary Magdalene, and they had kids, and they have a bloodline that exists today, and that's what it's, and there's this group, who included a lot of famous people throughout history, that are protecting that secret. So, I mean, if maybe people have their fingers in their ear, and they go, don't tell me. And there was a movie in the 50s or the 40s or something like that called The Greatest Story Ever Told. And in this, they say that the Jesus dying on the cross and resurrection thing is the greatest story ever sold. So it does, yeah. It probably offends very devout Christians and Catholics. But hey, we live in a pluralistic society. And most Christians that I know and Catholics, they're secure, I guess. I don't know whether they are or they aren't. But let's say they're secure in their beliefs. And people running around saying that, or there is no God, you know, they can deal with it. And so I don't know why these people can't. But get this. This Archbishop Arenzi says, those who blaspheme Christ and get away with it, whoa. I mean, isn't there supposed to be divine judgment? What do they care? People that are doing this, they're going right downstairs. Remember, anyways, I don't think everybody objects to that. What did Mark Twain say? Heaven for the climate, hell for the company. Anyways, those who blaspheme Christ, I mean, this sounds like the Middle Ages, and get away with it, are exploiting the Christian readiness to forgive and to love even those who insult us. Doesn't that sound ominous? Doesn't it sound like someone who really doesn't mean it? That they don't have a readiness to forgive and love? They don't love those who insult us? But get this line from this archbishop. There are some other religions which, if you insult their founder, they will not be just talking. They will make it painfully clear to you. Doesn't that sound threatening? Is this guy, like, advocating mob violence of the type that occurred around the printing of those cartoons about Muhammad? I mean, what do you make of this? There are some other religions which, if you insult their founder, they will not just be talking. They will make it painfully clear to you. Pretty weird. Anyway, I kind of ebb and flow on different religious groups, and certainly on Catholics. A lot of them are involved in the peace and social justice movement and the protection of the rights of immigrants, and have been really instrumental in fighting this hideous bill that would make human beings criminals because they're in the wrong, felons in the wrong place, and let alone if you gave them communion or you gave them counseling, you would be a felon as well. So, on the other hand, they are now involved with 50 prominent religious leaders, which includes 7 Roman Catholic cardinals and about half dozen archbishops, and they're signing a petition in support of a constitutional amendment blocking same-sex marriage. Now, this is disgraceful and doesn't exactly give me much sympathy to the fact that they feel insulted about things. They're also one of the leading forces against a woman's right to choose. So this is perfectly okay. We're going to take this founding political document that the first thing it guarantees is that no official religion be established. That's what the first thing. You know, I didn't even mean to bring that. I read that. Hold on. Let me grab this. I just brought this by accident, but I read this about 100 times on the air because I think it is so important. Amendment number one, Bill of Rights. Amendment number one does not, the first thing, doesn't guarantee us free speech. It doesn't guarantee us freedom of the press or the right to assemble or petition the government for the redress of grievances. In fact, it grants no rights to the people whatsoever, the first thing it mentioned. Those other things do. It says Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion, and besides the English, the church, the Anglican church being intertwined with the English monarchy, the founding fathers were also extraordinarily aware of the horrible role that the Catholic Church particularly played, intertwined with the other states in Europe, and the role of the Pope during the Middle Ages and into, you know, the Enlightenment area as well. So the idea then that they're returning to the way in which they functioned previously to start legislating how people should love or what kind of choices women should make about their reproductive rights is really kind of going back a little bit, and again, does not make me very sympathetic to what their concerns are about the Da Vinci Code. Here in this article, I've been toting around for, I don't know how long. Where is this? Does this have a date on it? No. How can it not have a date? It's a news story. But, I mean, I've had it for about a month or something like that from Yahoo News, Associated Press. Public backlash over gay marriage has receded since a controversial decision by the Massachusetts Supreme Court. Yada, yeah. It says gay marriage remains a divisive issue with 51% opposing it, but almost two-thirds, 63% opposed gay marriage in February 2004. The number of people who say they are strongly opposed to gay marriage has dropped from 42% in early 2004 to only 28%. And those are probably real religious people. And, you know, you can oppose it. You can hate it. You can think it's terrible. You can run around saying stupid things like God created Adam and Eve, not Adam and Steve, and stuff like that, and think that's real, you know, real, real cute, or you really stumbled on something. But ultimately, you know, people love who they love, and people's sexuality is what it is, and we all ought to mind our own business. Wouldn't that be a good start? Don't we want, I mean, this is where the conservatives say, get the government off our back. Yet they want to legislate into the foundation document of the United States of America who can marry who. Some of this I've said before, and I don't have anything new to say about it. Years ago, someone said, what if somebody wanted to marry their dog? I mean, for one thing, that is such an insult to people in love that are of the same sex that most of us know or know of. I know plenty of gay couples that live happily and are good citizens, not even, well, all right. But if somebody wanted to marry their dog, I wouldn't care. Why would you? Why would you care if somebody wanted to marry their dog? Go for it. That's what I say. They can even have sex with it. I know. No, maybe that's animal abuse. They shouldn't do that. Never mind. All right. Any thoughts about the Da Vinci Code or any of this? But I don't know. All right, I'm going to say this one more time. I've said it before. To me, having in a political document like the Michigan Constitution that we disgracefully inserted into that in 2004 by popular vote would be comparable to saying that only white Christians could marry or something like that. Because what's the difference? I mean, when that was law, when only whites could marry, and states had laws against miscegenation, people of African origin and people of European origin, they were forbidden up till 1967. That's how long, and that, I don't know if it was in constitutions or not in southern states, but it certainly was their laws, and they had to be overturned by the Supreme Court. I mean, they didn't get a clue in the South that after 1954 that, hey, maybe this was not the way to go. And there's other places, certainly in Nazi Germany, only white Aryans or Aryan Christians could marry. And we thought that was horrible. So why is it any different? Why is it any different? Well, man and woman, I mean, screw that. Yeah, come on, it's the 21st century. All right. Oil. They're still ripping us. You know, we're starting to get a little angry. They're talking about excess profits taxes and I guess this totally stupid idea of giving us a $100 rebate just sank real quickly. Remember, most of those rebates would be just coming out of the taxes that we would be, the tax rebate that we were getting anyway, so it wouldn't be any big deal. But it says, this is another Associated Press account. High pump prices are pinching the pocketbooks of 7 in 10 Americans, 70% of us, a financial hardship that more middle and higher income drivers say they're beginning to feel. Now, we have 39 million of us that are making under 30,000, so that's really hurting those people. Gasoline prices in some areas topping $3 a gallon. Oh, yeah, we started to make a lot of noise. That was my point. And so they did, you know, they dropped it down about a dime. Because they know what they keep doing, right? We used to be, not so long ago, about $1.70 or something like that. Then they went away at like $2.50, and then they dropped it down. And so they keep doing two steps forward, one step back. And they're going to drive it up to about $5 a gallon. I mean, unless we really do something. Not if we just complain. They're really going to do something. The number of people who expect rising gas prices to cause financial problems in the months ahead has jumped from 51% a year ago to 70% now. The increase has been dramatic among people who earn more than $50,000. I almost spilled a whole cup of water here. Get this. There's an article in the business section of the New York Times on May 3rd called Sympathy as Hard to Find as Oil. And they're talking about how what a bad rap. And not bad rap means it's incorrect. What a rap, I guess you're saying, you would say, that the oil executives are getting. But and they're trying real hard. Senator John McCain said, outside of satanic cults, these people, the oil companies, have the worst public relations of anybody in the world. It's not for want of trying, says the Times article. In their latest counteroffensive to that type of demonization, the big oil companies and their trade groups have stepped up their own campaign, spending millions of dollars on television, radio, and newspaper advertisements in the hopes of blunting the reaction. So they're spending millions and millions of dollars to convince us that this really isn't so bad, that we shouldn't mind that that we are taking a pay cut, that we shouldn't mind that more of the wealth that we produce through our labor is being taken by these huge giant corporations. That, oh, it's okay. Because have you seen those ads? And they say that, oh, they, you know, there's pharmaceuticals and banking and all these other people that make extraordinarily more return on their dollar. Like here, I got this one, Starbucks, you know, the coffee company, right? Coffee shops. 27%, the Starbucks Corporation reported a 27% rise in quarterly earnings Wednesday, citing brisk demand for its coffee drinks. Well, they're brisk. They got 10 times more caffeine than what you get in just a diner. But anyway, that's not the point. The point being that they would say, see, look, we're only, let me see, I thought this was somewhere in here. They're like bringing back like eight cents on a, I don't know, where the hell was it? Anyways, they're making like 8 cents on a dollar or something like that. Of course, their sales are extraordinary. Their story, their sales are just like way, way over the top in terms of total, total sales, the aggregate sales, the gross sales are so enormous that if you start doing 8% of that, it still makes them the most profitable companies in the world. And again, it's all about how wealth is distributed. And I know there's a lot of you that are you're middle class and working class, and for some reason you always want to protect the wealth of the people that are the wealthy power sources in this society. I don't get it. But it all falls in some way or other. Even if you love these millionaires and billionaires, it all still has to be, how does the money that's created, the wealth that's created, how does it get distributed? And if it's just sort of happens, which it doesn't, it's set up this way purposely, so there's ultra wealthy people and dirt poor people living on a dollar or two a day. It's set up like that. It's not just an accident. It just didn't happen that things wound up like that. So this is a redistribution of wealth, except it's going the wrong way. It's going to the people that don't need it from the people that do need it, from the middle class and from the working class, and particularly from the poor who still have to drive. I was looking for a letter here. Oh, yeah. Don't use my name or company on the air. I won't. But this was sent by Chris, not even really the whole name. Chris, to calltalkyes@yahoo.com. Here's a quote from the article. For their part, oh, here's where it was, too. The oil companies have been emphasizing that they make far less money on each dollar of sales than many other industries that aren't being excoriated for their capitalism. Taken together, Exxon, Chevron, and ConocoPhillips make a profit of $8.19 on every $100 in sales. In contrast, Internet, Bellwethers, Google, Yahoo, and what have you, collectively turn in almost $20 on every $100. But here's what Chris says. I don't need Google and Yahoo to get to work. I need gas. Sorry, I don't own a farm with horses, so I can get around without gas. If I had a horse, I wouldn't be able to park it out in front of the office all day. So they've got us by the cojones, and they know it. And they're Bush Co., Bush Incorporated, the BFC, the Bush crime family, is facilitating that worse than any other of the presidencies before that, and they all did it. But if you look, who's making out? Who makes out on this? And who gets hurt? It's pretty, and it's not just the oil companies. It's all along the way. It's the production companies, the transportation companies, the people that are trading in it, the refiners, the people at the gas pump don't make any more money. But this is a redistribution of wealth from the poor, that's us, the peasantry, the middle class and below, up to the rulers. And they're waiting to see what we do. And nothing too much. I mean, we're starting to complain. We're starting to get a clue that these aren't our buddies, that they do have separate interests from us. They stick together. We don't stick together. If we start sticking together, they start saying, you're doing class warfare. And we go, oh, no, sorry. I didn't mean to do that. But there was one other little thing in here about, let me see if this is still at the here. Remember, the Exxon chairman so they've spent millions trying to convince us that they're not charging us too much. They gave the Exxon chairman $400 million as a retirement package, and they could have done something. They could have done something like reduce their gas prices, huh? How about that? I don't know. I mean, split up, that's not a lot, but it's an indication of the kind of wealth that they have. I mean, it's like Walmart. That's what they've done. Rather than give their employees decent health benefits or give them decent wages, they spend tens of millions of dollars on public relations, trying to convince everybody that they're not just this big ripoff. Here, too, let's go back to Venezuela, where we've been. Venezuelan President Hugo Chavez is leading the way to form what he calls an axis of good. Remember, there's the axis of evil. He wasn't included in that. And these in the axis of good are countries opposed to U.S. foreign policy, essentially Bush foreign policy. He's going to London this week, and he's going to meet with the mayor of London, Ken Livingstone, and others who oppose what they see as U.S. imperialism, according to the Sunday Times. His social programs have built a strong base of support in the poor and rural areas of Venezuela. They're talking about how in Bolivia last week, President Evo Morales move to nationalize the energy industry. Is that a clue? So here's what happens. I just filled up today at Citgo. $45. I don't have an SUV, but I got a big car, full-size car. And so it was about $45. That's probably about $15 more than I would like to pay. But I was in Caracas, and I was in Venezuela, and I saw how the poor people still live, even with everything that the government has done for them. I mean, you can't believe, or maybe you can, the extent of poverty and the depth of it, and how many billions and billions and billions of dollars of wealth shifted to the poor is necessary in order to take them out of that situation. So I did know, even though I paid more than I wanted, I really salved my feelings by saying, this is going directly to the poor of Venezuela. There's no stockholders there. There's not some guy getting $400 million a year of our money that we've paid him, somebody who could probably retire in the finest style imaginable for 10% of that, but rather it's going directly to poor people. And so, that Chavez has been characterized negatively in American newspapers, but I don't know. Anybody got an idea of there's anything wrong with what Chavez is doing or has done? I don't see it. I mean, I've got some criticisms of him, that's for sure, but they're not the usual ones. Okay, I've been yakking for a while. If you want to call, 313-298-WRIF is our phone number. Calltalkyes@yahoo.com. Calltalkyes@yahoo.com. We'll be right back after these.
And now, a word from the Riff Legal Eagles. Unless otherwise stated, all entrants for WRIF contests must be at least 18 years of age and a legal resident of the United States. A household is eligible to win one contest per 30 days every 6 months for prizes valued at $600 or higher. Greater Media Detroit and its affiliates, promotional sponsors, advertising and promotional agencies, and other radio and television stations in the Detroit ADI are not eligible to participate. One entry per person. No purchase or other consideration is necessary to participate in the contest. Void where prohibited. Prizes are non-transferable or redeemable for cash. 101 WRIF reserves the right to substitute any prize for one of equal or greater value. By participating in the contest, contestants consent to the broadcast and or publication of their name, voice, face, and or likeness without compensation. Participants listening online at www.wrif.com may receive audio that is delayed by as much as 60 seconds later than the over-the-air transmission, which could potentially affect chances of winning. General contest rules are available online at www.wrif.com or during regular business hours at the WRIF Studios, One Radio Plaza, Detroit, Michigan, 48220.
You're listening to WRIF.com.
with more Night Call on 101 WRIF Detroit. Here's Peter Werby.
All right, thank you very much, and welcome back. We're talking a little about the Da Vinci Code and the Catholic Church objection to it, also gasoline prices, and how this is a redistribution of income. Everything like this is. It's Robin Hood economics in reverse. It steals from the poor and gives to the rich. And I want to get right to the phones, even a couple open lines for you. 313-298-WRIF. And remember there was a little hoopla? It's so nice that that didn't go anywhere, that there was a version of the Star Spangled Banner came out in Spanish, and God, all these patriots went nuts. People always go nuts about stuff. The only time I go nuts about stuff is when people are being hurt. And you're not getting hurt by somebody singing the Star Spangled Banner in Spanish. Well, they asked Bush. They said, what do you think about that? He said, no, I think it should be sang in English. So he's really standing up for the symbols of our country. Except, this is in Kevin Phillips' new book, American Dynasty, and it's about the 2000 electoral campaign. When visiting cities like Chicago, Milwaukee, or Philadelphia in pivotal states, George W. Bush would drop in at the Hispanic festivals and parties, sometimes joining and singing the Star Spangled Banner in, you guessed it, Spanish, sometimes partying with a Viva Bush mariachi band flown in from Texas. So Bush was singing the Star Spangled Banner in Spanish. All right. Let's go to our phones. This is Paul, and Paul is in Clinton Township. Hi, Paul. You're on the air. Welcome.
How's it going?
Going great.
Yeah, I wanted to comment briefly on gas prices. A friend of mine and I were going over the numbers last week.
Sure.
And we noticed, you know, in the mid-90s, we had gas prices that were, you know, a little over a dollar a gallon, but by the barrel, it was $50, $55. Since then, we've looked at, like, you know, 50% increase by the barrel, but $3 at the pump.
Yeah.
So, you know, we kind of noticed, you know, from that perspective, that they're kind of really, you know, raping us.
Well, sure. That the figures are there, and that's important. That's good that you're doing that. But also, it would be if everything went up equally because there was a scarcity, their profit would be the same, right?
Yeah, and we also figured for things like inflation and, you know, newer technologies going into the filtration.
Yeah, well, the question is, what do we do? And, you know, there's been some calls for boycotts. There was a call for a boycott of ExxonMobil in this small New York town because there was four Exxon stations. I guess it's not that small. And then they were all owned by local owners. So you wound up kind of screwing them. And so they had to kind of pull back. But in a way, I remember I was saying earlier, I don't know if you heard that, but I was saying I always buy at Citgo because at least if I'm going to get ripped off, I know that the profits of it aren't just going to line some rich guy's pockets.
Yeah, actually, I heard that somewhere else, too. And since I heard that, I've been buying it since I've got one right next to my house. So.
Yeah, I mean, I have one close. I don't know, to be honest, if I had to travel a great distance in order to get Citgo, I don't know if I would do it. One of the things I'm sort of surprised at is that that Chavez doesn't reduce the price. I wonder if he can actually do that.
Well, to my understanding, he was actually trying to standardize the price per barrel at somewhere around $55 per gallon.
Exactly.
Per barrel.
He does want to do that. He wants to I think it's $50 a barrel and okay. And keep it there. But you know, one of the things I forgot to mention this earlier. You know, this whole deal with Iran and nukes and all of that, that's one of the things that they point to that has created this rise in prices. It's not that just that it's become scarcer and there's more demand, like, you know, we see these intersection of supply and demand lines like we learned in high school econ, right? But rather it's based on futures and what people anticipate it's going to be sold for. So if they think, whoa, things are unstable in Nigeria or Bush is having it out with Venezuela or that it looks like there could be a confrontation with Iran and they could cut off supplies, well, that's why one of the reasons that the prices is going up. And all of a sudden, I had this thought, this is really working well for, of course, the oil-producing countries, because now Iran and Venezuela and Nigeria, everybody else, Canada, they're all getting more money for their oil, and so is Bush's buddies. This is all just a nice little racket.
Oh, yeah, and I've heard from a number of sources, I don't know how true it is, that to a degree, I mean, him and all these other people have been kind of in league for a while.
Yeah, right. They have.
You know, instances where I've heard that Osama had been in, like, hospitals in, what was it, Paris or France or, you know, somewhere over east, and they knew he was there. They just let him go.
I think he was even in Dubai. Remember Dubai?
That could be that, yeah.
Yeah. All right. Thanks a lot. I appreciate your call. I called him Paul. It looked like Ron Paul. There's actually a libertarian. Isn't he still from Texas? Ron Paul. 313-298-WRIF. Is it Stephanie?
Stephanie,
okay.
Hi.
Bad spelling here. Go ahead, Stephanie. Hi, you're on the air. It's Peter Werby.
Good evening. I'm a big fan listening to your show every week.
Well, thank you, Stephanie.
I was calling about why working people and middle-class people support the ultra-wealthy. It's a divide-and-conquer tactic. They tell the men, the middle-class, lower-class, white men, hey, don't band up with the minorities. Don't consider yourself equal with them. Wink, wink, nudge, nudge, this could be you. And, you know, if you do this, if you stay on our side, this could be you. You could have the limousines and the mansions. And with the women, women is competition and religion. Lower class women and middle class women, your neighbor goes out and gets a $350 pair of Jimmy Choo's, and then you go out and get a $450 pair of Manolo Blahniks, and then the neighbor on the other side of you goes out and gets a $600 pair of shoes. And the religion, women
wait.
Are more
Stephanie, involved. Wait, 1 second. People actually buy that, they pay yes. that for shoes?
They women spend a lot of time competing with one another, and they get the wink-wink nudge too. If your husband gets really rich, you can go shop like this all the time.
Wow. Well,
so women are there, and they also, the religious, when you go to a church, you will see a lot more women than you will men on a Sunday morning. A lot of husbands stay at home, or single guys just don't go, and you will see more women there. And piety, there's a lot of people who are really good in the church. I'm a pagan. I don't really do anything with that. But it's still kind of a competition in some communities who's more pious than the other woman.
That's how
the religious right got control of the Republican Party.
They got a hold
of the women.
I wonder what's happening in this country. I was just looking at this article. It was in the Free Press today. Actually, they reprinted it from the Chicago Tribune. But it says churches are now relics across Europe, and in the Czech Republic, which was always a very, very Catholic area, something like 19% of people say they're believers, and the churches are mostly empty.
And every week in the Free Press and the Detroit News, I read the faith columns and encouraging people to go to church. And this is a big deal. This is in the newspaper every day about American faith, and Mary was sighted on an underpass, and people are so obsessed with this. They turn everything, and they will turn anything into a religion because their lives are empty. So they will sell themselves out to the ultra wealthy for the idea that they could be like them.
Hmm. Well, I appreciate all that. Thank you, Stephanie.
All right.
Thanks for having joined us at 313-298-WRIF. Now, don't you always think of those Eastern European people as being very religious? According to the survey, 19% of Czechs said they believed in God. Most of the rest proclaimed themselves atheists. Only the former Soviet Republic of Estonia had a lower percentage of believers. We were always kind of told that they all wanted to worship. They just wanted to be free of Soviet domination. Jan Kittrich, a 30-year-old Prague lawyer, is typical. He described himself as an atheist, but quickly added he had nothing against churches. He says, I love to visit them. I see them as historical objects, not as religious places. Let's see. The Czechs are far from alone. From Ireland to Italy, church attendance across Europe is down drastically, apart from Western Europe's rapidly growing Muslim communities and the staunch piety of Poles in the East. Religion is a moral force in public life, continues to wane. Drops. How interesting. All right. 313-298-WRIF. It's Ron in Ann Arbor. Ron, hi. It's Peter Werby. You're on the air.
Hi, Pete. It's the first time I've heard your station. I just had it coming back from Chicago. But listen, one thing, actually a couple of things here that you brought up here. But the first thing is you were talking about, you know, homosexuality. I don't have anything against two men or two women getting together. But I mean, where do you draw the line? I mean, what if you let's just say you get like I know that what's at the Mormons at one time. In fact, I think there's one sect in the northern or no southern part of Utah that, you know, they still believe in having, you know, seven or eight wives. Where would you draw the line as to, you know, how many people can be married to each other?
Well, I don't know. What in a way, unless we can really show that there's harm, and maybe there is. I mean, there that's a very, very patriarchal sect, and so that the women, I mean, they're always getting in trouble because they're marrying off, like, their 12-year-old daughters to their somebody else in the sect. Now that, obviously, but all of those things are arbitrary. Like, when should you be able to get married? Should you be able to get married when you're 18, 17, 16, 15, 14? I don't know.
Well, that's a good point. I mean, you know, like they're talking about how young boys that are thrown into prison forever, that's not right because their mind's not developed yet. I mean, to have a 13-year-old married to, say, a 30-year-old, and I know...
That's terrible.
Yeah, and that, but I know that happens in some parts. Some religions allow it. I mean, they're all for it. I don't know. I mean, it sounds like you're saying, well, anything can go, you know. And I'm saying, well, no, I think someone's got to somehow a group or a society's got to come to some kind of agreement and say, you know, this is not right.
Well, I suspect so, and I know, like for instance, in India, oftentimes very very young girls are married to elderly men. The men die, and then the women are forbidden to remarry, and they live these sad, lonely lives. But we've arrived at a point of tolerance where we don't do what one of our great allies in Iraq has done, and that's called for a fatwa, call to murder homosexuals. We're going in the absolute opposite direction. I don't know. That's interesting. If someone said to me, I'm going to live polygamously with eight women. I mean, I couldn't imagine doing this. One is real tough, as I'm sure most men would agree and most women would agree. But if somebody said, well, we're adults and we want to have the sanctity of the state because that allows us to get certain benefits, and what have you? I don't know. Why are we against polygamy?
Well, I don't know. I guess does it have something to do with disease? Does it have something to do with the bringing up the children? Who's responsible for the children?
It's certainly not disease, but I don't know. I mean,
I think if you have multiple, I'm not sure on this, but I think females, if they have multiple partners, don't they develop ovarian cancer or something?
Wait a minute. We're talking about one guy and many women. We're not talking about polyandry, which is the other way, where in very, very, there's a few societies where they have several husbands for one woman, but that's usually in primitive tribes. But there's not a lot of polygamous societies that I know of, and the most modern, the only modern expression that I know of is among these Mormon sects. In fact, in order to get into the Union, Utah had to pass a law that disallowed that. They weren't gonna allow it to be a state until they got rid of it. But there, as you said, there's these little sects around. So on the face of it, I'm not opposed to polygamy. Because I don't care what people do as long as they're not,
hurting.
Huh?
Do you have children yourself?
I don't have children myself. No.
Oh. So are you married, single, or does?
I mean, I am married.
Oh. I think that once you get, when you have children after a while, I think your mind, because I know when you don't have children, you think differently. I think I thought more like you. Like, I don't give a darn what happens. But I think once you have children and your mind does change, the responsibility in your mind changes. And I think that's where people become more conservative. And I think then that's where you get your ultra conservatives who go all the way to far extreme. I mean, I was a scout leader. I would have been happy to have anyone to help me because I couldn't get parents to help me out.
Yeah.
But then eventually the far left kicked our Cub Scout group right out of the grade school. We couldn't even, and I mean, these little boys.
Well, wait a minute. If you had eight moms, you might have, for every Cub Scout or Boy Scout, you might have more of a chance. Ron, let me carry on to some other people. I appreciate your call. Thanks for listening and calling us for the first time. I appreciate that greatly. So I don't know. How do you come to these social conclusions? Obviously, you don't want 8-year-olds marrying people. You don't want 12-year-olds, 13-year-olds, 14-year-olds, 15. Then you start to get 16. I mean, what kind of, then you get, I think in a lot of states, if you're 16, you have parental permission, you can. I don't even know what the law is in Michigan. Does anybody know that? 313-298-WRIF. Look it up on Google for me and tell us. But who objects to polygamy and on what basis? On the face of it, I don't. I mean, it's very, very, the only way that this works, it's totally patriarchal. The guy is absolutely in charge of all the rest of them, I think. I can't imagine any way. I mean, if you had kind of an equality there, there'd be hell to pay. I mean, even imagine, I mean, think about the arguments. If this is for the guys, think about the arguments you have with the women in your life. Well, what if they had an ally? All right. Well, not, what if they had three allies? You wouldn't be doing well. So I think what it is that the guy kind of runs the show. There's some, isn't it, HBO program on about all that? But I don't know. I've never seen it, not having cable. All right, right back. Call in the meantime, 313-298-WRIF. I noticed that there's nobody calling in with an objection to polygamy. On the face of it, we think we don't like it. But why don't we like it? Tell me.
Every Tuesday, get double shots of the best riffed rock.
The way you want it.
See, I told you there was a rational explanation.
2 for Tuesday on 101 WRIF. Everything that rocks.
This is WRIF.com.
Yeah.
maybe five.
Night Call is back on 101 WRIF Detroit. Here's your host, Peter Werby.
All right, thanks a lot, and welcome back to our second hour. 1 hour under our belt. Again, talking about the Da Vinci Code and also gas prices. And somehow, Ron, a first-time listener and caller, and welcome to him at 313-298-WRIF and to the rest of you, brought up the idea about, I was talking about the Da Vinci Code, saying I didn't have a lot of sympathy for the Catholic Church because they've been on the wrong side of a lot of social questions that I'm interested in, like, for instance, forbidding gay marriage. And Ron said, well, what about stuff like polygamy? And I sort of said, well, I don't know. What is wrong with polygamy? I mean, how much should the government intervene in controlling personal behavior? A lot of things. We want it to be able to control people hurting other people. We have some things that we've come to a conclusion about. We don't want 50-year-olds marrying 9-year-olds, so that there are things like that. I mean, most of us that over the years that are listening to WRIF at least have a fairly libertarian view about drug laws. Don't think there should be a drug law. Don't think that marijuana ought to make you a felon and stuff like that. Hey, speaking of that, by the way, I want to stay on this polygamy thing because a lot of you want to comment on it. Last week, I read the report that Mexico had decriminalized small amounts of drugs, including like meth and PCP, but cocaine and heroin. And all it had to do was be signed by Vicente Fox, El Presidente de Mexico. But he got the word from the boss, from the White House, who said, we want to keep this illegal because without drugs being illegal, we don't have a prison industrial complex and we can't take billions and billions of dollars from the taxpayers. Because if you start making it legal and Canada, remember, was going to make it possession of marijuana, decriminalize that until this conservative guy Harper got in. So anyways, Vicente Fox said that he is refusing to sign this drug decriminalization bill hours after U.S. officials warned him. Nice to have an independent country, isn't it? Yeah. All right, let's see. Let's go to our phones. Here is Jeff. Jeff is in Auburn Hills. How you doing, Jeff?
I'm on the phone.
You are? You are indeed on the phone. You're on the air, too. Go ahead.
Nice.
You're on the air.
This is my first time ever actually listening to this. And it's quite interesting myself.
Well, thank you.
The subject of polygamy. The first off, the show you were looking for, it's called Big Love.
Oh, yeah.
And Bill Paxton was the star who has three wives.
Okay.
Recently in the development, his first wife that he first married, he's now falling in love with. And the other two wives are getting jealous, and they're not realizing that they're having an affair.
Oh, my God.
So, yeah, it's a slight twist, and it's actually pretty interesting if you do follow it.
Well, I mean, given our supposedly monogamous, both culturally and socially and even legally, I mean, how many glitches are there in that, right?
Well, over time, I think people just grew accustomed to traditions such as marrying one woman to one man. And back in the day, that used to be nonsense. I mean, if you look in the Bible in the early days, they had multiple wives all the time, and they were breeding like crazy.
Yeah.
You'd have like 200 kids, something like that, in the Old Testament. And that just blows my mind that someone can even find that feasible, let alone, I mean, acceptable back then. But on that subject, I agree with you. I don't see what's wrong with polygamy. If they feel it's right and they want to do it, more power to them.
Yeah, I think it has to really have these, what would you say, these controls. I think, in other words, that if you or I...
Regulations, possibly?
Well, internal, but, I mean, that are sort of superimposed upon it. Because if just like an individual like you or me decided to have four wives.
Yeah, it would get out of hand.
Yeah, it would get way out of hand. But they, I guess, have a way to keep it in hand. Well, Jeff, thanks.
Yeah, go ahead. Oh, that brings up a great point. I mean, if they can find a way to control it, where, I mean, not so much restrict it, but have a, like, I don't know, conditions such as a certain number of wives up to a point, because I'd find it ridiculous if you had 9 or 10 wives and then each wife had 5 kids. That's 50 kids right there.
Yeah. Well, I think it's a big arena of male domination, and dominating people, just the thought of it makes me tired, actually. All right. Thanks a lot. Appreciate your call. Here's Matthew in Canton. Matthew, hi. Peter Werby on WRIF. You're there, too. Go ahead.
How you doing?
Good, thanks.
Good. Ultra conservative, long-time listener.
So, thank you.
You know, I just kind of wanted to say that, I think that me personally, I kind of put the gay marriage and the polygamy thing, for that matter, kind of in the same boat as abortion, whereas for me, do I believe it's immoral? Yes. But then again, there's the other side where you could say, well, it is kind of wrong for an institution to say that that's wrong, because I'm a big believer in separation of church and state.
Okay.
So,
well, you're not a conservative. You sound more like a libertarian.
Well, yeah, I don't like labels, to be honest with you.
Okay, neither do I. Neither do I.
I'm me. That's what I like to call it. So.
That's good.
But to be honest with you, I do think that there is a lot of people on the pro-gay marriage and pro-abortion side that tend to bash Christians kind of unfairly, and that's kind of what bothers me, because I am personally a Christian, and I do not, if you will, force my beliefs on anyone else, saying that you have to follow this. It's a personal relationship between me and my Creator. But for them to kind of come back and say, well, you're a, you know, a crazy Christian or a radical right, I kind of think that there's two sides to this boat here, and I don't think that at times those people are being very fair as well.
Well, sticks and stones. I mean, sure. You know, the most, like, the only Christians I know, and I know lots of them, and every one of them, almost to a person, is very, very liberal. So I think they would follow the tenets of, well, it depends on what church they belong to. A lot of churches in the Detroit area. In fact, I live in this Ferndale, Royal Oak area, and there's a number of gay churches, for instance. So I would say that all the Christians that I know, they can call me if I'm wrong and they're listening, but all the Christians I know support gay marriage, for instance.
Well, you know, I wouldn't go so far as to say that I personally support it. All that I'm saying is that I don't believe that any institution that's man-made, i.e. our government, could mandate that gay marriage is technically illegal. I think you can think that something is immoral but not illegal.
Yeah. Okay. Good enough. I appreciate it, Matthew. Thank you for calling in. 313-298-WRIF. You can grab a line. I think, yeah, there's one open. And here, well, we got a call from one of our internet listeners. Here's Joe in Long Beach, California. Joe, hi, it's Peter Werby. Welcome. Jeez, it's still, the sun must be up still, huh?
No, but I do enjoy your earlier hours these days.
Okay, good. Go ahead, you're on the air.
Yeah, you guys are talking about polygamy, and basically from a numbers standpoint, it just will not work out.
Why?
Well, I don't know if everybody knows, but the actual birth rate is 105 males to every 100 females, so actually there's more men born, and that's pretty much standard worldwide, except for, like, China, for example, where they practice female infanticide, and then you have such a... crazy extreme numbers. We were talking, you know, 117 males to every 100 females available. It mathematically does not work out. And
well, wait a minute. We're not talking about universalizing it. We're assuming that most people would not go for this. I'm just wondering whether we should make outlaws of these people that, because of their religious beliefs, are polygamous. And I guess I'm waiting for someone to tell me what the rationalization is for making it illegal.
Well, quite like this Jeffords guy who just got added to the FBI most wanted list. I'm not sure if you heard that yet or not.
I saw the headline. Tell us about it, though. He was a polygamist.
He's a polygamist, and they have a pretty much their own city, and the police and everybody, the whole town is completely corrupt and based upon polygamy. This was...
Wait. Why is it corrupt? I mean, are you...
They harass anybody that comes from the outside, It's like America, but it's like their own separate section.
Okay, that's not corrupt. But that's unacceptable. But go ahead.
Well, it is. I mean, you know, you're supposed to be free to travel anywhere.
Yeah, I mean, corrupt usually means you're on the take, it's like the Bush government is corrupt.
Well, the police in that town and the government support these people and keep out invaders, you know, that would jeopardize these people.
It sounds like an episode from The X-Files.
Well, from what I remember, this was a few years back, and the FBI finally caught up to them today. So they've been on them for several years. So it's fairly interesting. And, you know, how they work is they just keep trading off their own kids to other people. And it's pretty much what normal people would say, a fairly sick way to go, because they're just taking their young daughters or whatever and keeping them there and holding them pretty much against their own will. And even some of the kids do not know who the president was. That's how just far off course they are.
Oh, the president. Okay. Well, none of that. If people are, like, for instance, like I said, I think people got the idea that that I'm opposed to the drug laws. Doesn't mean that I think people ought to get high and then be able to fly an airplane or drive a car or anything like that, right? So that there's use and misuse of everything that we do. And one of the keys is not harming other people, not having power over people to determine their lives in a way that they don't have any say about it. I mean, that's one of the reasons that I'm so opposed to this, to the government that we have. So when you say that, that doesn't seem to me to be an argument against polygamy. It seems to be an argument about how these people who are polygamists are functioning. All right, Joe, thanks for calling from so far away. I appreciate it. Anybody else listening on the internet, give us a call, 313-298-WRIF. I know you'd like to have a toll-free number, but hey, you know, I've got this thing through the regular big phone company. Is that I pay like $50 a month, isn't it, something like that? And you get all your calls. So I could sit on hold for a long time. Here's Gary in Detroit. Thanks for calling 313-298-WRIF. You're on the air. Go ahead, Gary. You're on the air.
Hi,
Peter. Hi.
Well, you know, you're asking about, do people have a problem with it, with polygamy? I don't think people have. I think it's like communism. I think people don't have so much a problem with the concept as they do with the reality. The fact of the matter is that you have all these underage girls being passed around by the leaders. It's like basically they can dictate who will and have how many wives they have. But also it's because you can only have one legal wife in any, just about anywhere you live in this country. The fact of the matter is they have all these kids and they can't support them. And then what goes is that wives 3 through 8 end up going on public assistance, and the taxpayers end up paying for these old men to sit here and like bang up one young wife after another.
So actually it is something that, what you're saying, that the religious tenets are trumped by the economic realities of the ability to support a family.
Of course, in this day and age, yeah. And the problem is you got like all these dirty old men basically taking one underage wife after another, and then they're ordering other members, because they're like cults,
right.
They're ordering members to surrender their daughters. And the one person talking about the birth weight, well, it's irrelevant because the powerful members get more wives, and, you know, the guys who don't, well, they're basically just, I was just stuck with one.
Well, here's what I'm thinking. I've known and have read, many of us have, those things that are certainly unacceptable. And you bring up that economic aspect, which I think is a consideration as well. But those, what we're talking about is that people are, well, I don't know. This is one of these things that, I always think if there were polygamists living next door to me, I'd wonder, do they play their radio loud and do they cut their lawn? But I guess if they were behaving terribly towards their children and trading them around, like you say, I would be concerned about that as well. All right, thanks, Gary. You can see that I'm trying to be libertarian about this, but people are bringing up arguments that you find this to be offensive. But is this polygamists who are acting offensively? Because what if you just did things straight up? You are 35 and you have 3 wives that are like 25, 30, and 35, and you have children, and you don't turn them over to the cult leader and what have you. What's wrong with that? I don't know. Tell me. 313-298-WRIF. Here's Lester in Port Huron. Hi, Lester. You're on the air.
How you doing?
Doing good. Thanks.
It, you bring up some very interesting points. I consider myself very libertarian, and I think about these things very often. You ask about same-sex marriage and the like and polygamy, and I tend to disagree with those things. I consider myself Christian. Actually, I was a Baptist preacher for a while, and I do have a problem, biblically speaking, with the concept. However, as a member of society, I have to ask myself the question, what place does government have in my life when I'm harming no one else?
Okay.
And, I mean, I wanted to ask you a question. What was the place, what is the place of government?
Well, tending in the opposite direction from a statist, I would like to see it have a as small a role as possible.
What is the purpose of them, I guess my question is?
Well, I guess to regulate human affairs I'd say, you know, that's an interesting question. You would think I would have an extraordinarily eloquent and quick answer. I mean, mostly throughout history, it's been to rip off most of society, the benefit of the rulers at the top, right?
Well, you know, in government, its simplest form is people. Society, I guess that's redundant. Societies are formed for the sole purpose of protecting individuals' rights of life, liberty, and property, and they can better do that collectively. I have a right, an inherent right of life, liberty, and property, and we collectively form a society to protect those rights from each other and outside forces. And when government oversteps its bounds and starts to infringe upon those rights, then it's defeating the very purpose of government in and of itself.
All right, but let's get back to what we think as harm-free activity. Like, for instance, if you're a libertarian in that regard, like I am, you don't think marijuana should be against the law. Am I correct?
I am against all drug laws.
Yes. Okay, I'm against all drug laws as well. However, if someone was trying to sell it to 12-year-olds, we'd both be opposed to that, right? Or would you? I would be. Hello? Well,
I'm contemplating that.
Okay.
Then that poses a tough question in of itself. Yeah, I would be opposed to the selling of 12-year-olds.
And you're opposed, obviously, as I said earlier, to someone snorting cocaine and then flying the airplane that we're on.
Sure, but yeah. I don't have a problem somebody snorting cocaine of themselves.
No, I don't care what they do, as long as they cut their grass and don't play their radio loud.
And it goes back to the idea of what places of the government get in my individual life if I'm not harming other people.
That's right.
If I'm snorting cocaine to get up in the morning and go to work, how is that affecting anybody?
Well, the argument to some extent is that it becomes a social liability in the way that Gary from Detroit said that polygamy, if people routinely can't support their kids, that they go on, the public wealth has to support them. But if someone can't go to work without snorting coke, and I've known people like that, I know people, and I've said this little bit a long time, but I've over the years have known judges, lawyers, police, school teachers, almost every profession there is that could not work unless they were, high on marijuana. Whereas the opposite would always be true with me. Talk about recreational. But what they were using it for was obviously was self-medicating. They needed something about the quality of a marijuana high that allowed them to do what they had to do. Now, I mean, we don't like the idea of somebody, our lawyer, or I've never known a doctor that's gotten high while on work, but I bet they have.
Have you ever heard of a book by the name of The Law by Frederick Bastiat?
The name of the law? No.
The name of the book is The Law, and it's called The Law, and it's by a gentleman, he's a Frenchman, by the name of Frederick Bastiat. It's a small book. It's about 100 pages long. You would do good to read that. He's discussing in there, it's a treatise against socialism, but he's discussing in there the purpose of the law.
Well, I'm sort of a weird Well, actually, what I am, and we're going to end it with this, a libertarian socialist. That seems contradictory, doesn't it? Some other time we'll talk about that. Thanks for joining us. I appreciate it. Let's see here. Because I distrust and fear government, yet think that there is a... I hate to say this word because this tips so many people over the edge. A collective responsibility like there is in a family for us to take care of one another that most of us don't need taking care of. So it's not a big worry. But there are people that fall through the cracks for one reason or another. And like I said about buying gasoline at Citgo, where I know at least if I'm being ripped off at the pump, it's going to the poor people of Venezuela and not to the rich people of Palm Springs. All right, let's go to Randy in Redford. Randy, hi, it's Peter Werby. You're on the air.
Hi, Peter. How you doing?
Doing good, thanks.
First time caller here, by the way.
Oh, welcome. Welcome. Double welcome.
Thank you. About your polygamy issues, I kind of caught in on, a little bit in towards it. But I was watching something on television, a documentary, and... the little society they got going on is pretty messed up if you really get into it. I mean, some of those groups there, they actually, do a little inbreeding. And it's some of the first things that they showed. And then the rest of it was more like then they would go and get other wives.
Wait a minute, is this the TV drama or this was a documentary?
No, it was a documentary.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right.
It was all about... Salt Lake City.
Yeah.
And it was really,
Yeah. Well, Mormon, I don't mean to step on anybody's toes, but Mormonism and the tenets of it and the story of it are a little peculiar from where I sit. And I'm being real nice about it. They're also very, very patriarchal and they're very, very conservative. And so I think they've got a lot of problems kind of going into the whole deal. And they wouldn't be my ideal candidates for a workable polygamy.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So, it would seem to me that modern women, and those women that are in those polygamous relationships are probably not the ideal of the modern woman. But like I said earlier, two modern women, they could they would run the whole show on a modern man, don't you think?
Yeah.
Yeah. Let alone three or four.
Yeah, it's messed up. And
you said what? And they go, yeah. What did you say to her? I said, well, yeah.
And the messed up thing about it is a lot of them are preachers or what have you, and they do a lot of the marrying themselves. It's really,
yeah. Like I said, maybe they're not the best candidate. But I always think what happens with couples when they disagree that one of them, the guy usually says, I didn't say that. Sometimes women do as well. Say, I didn't say that. And she says, yes, you did. I say, I never said that. And you're thinking, there's no way we can ever prove this. Well, if there were two of them or three, they go, yes, you did. You said that. So, I don't know. Maybe it's unworkable. All right, thanks, Randy. Appreciate it. Thanks for being a first-time caller. 313-298-WRIF. It's Leo in Sterling Heights. Hi, Leo. You're on the air.
Hello, Peter. I originally started about the polygamy question, but now I have to, I'd like to just ask you about your thoughts about the role of government. It seems like it appears that you feel like the role of government is to allow you to do what you want to do rather than protect. I don't know. I thought you made a statement originally about protecting ourselves from.
Well, listen, government began as a racket. It began when a small number of people within these egalitarian societies that were these primitive tribal groupings began to accumulate wealth and began to exercise dictatorial power over other people. Well, they couldn't get away with it because it would be like if there were you and me and like four or five others of us, and all of a sudden I started trying to tell you what to do and everyone else what to do. And everybody would say, screw you, Peter. Who the hell are you? Well, there was that. So they began to buy a defensive force, which is essentially is the state, a group of armed men that enforce what the person that's able to dictate his rules. And still, that was pretty tough because you'd always be fighting. So then they erected religion to say that the ruler had been divinely ordained to have this position in society, and that society was no longer a circle where everybody and everything held hands, and there was an important everyone and everything had its role, but rather society then became shaped like a pyramid, where you had the archon, the leader, at the top. Then you had this layer of religiosity that that sanctified both the ruler and the nature of rule, the hierarchical rule. Beneath that, you had like all the king's men and what have you. And I mean, then you keep going farther and farther down to the base of the pyramid, and where you have less and less power, to the point where you're in the original societies, you're a slave and you're a nothing, and nature becomes nothing then as well, rather than an integral part of daily life. So to me, that government arose as a racket, never had any golden age. 99% of all governments have been tyrannical. And in Europe, about 300 years ago, people got the really goofy idea that maybe the ruled ought to have a little bit to say in the rules of society, rather than just having the ruler and the ruling class make all of the decisions. So we made a little bit along the way. I mean, as it is, mostly still the people with all the money make the big decisions, and they make the wars, and they get most of the profits and stuff like that. Once in a while, the common people, we get our back up and we say, hey, can we like end slavery, or can we stop child labor laws, or can you stop poisoning the air? And then if we really get angry and start getting together in big groups, then they go, okay, all right, you know, you can work only 10 hours a day instead of 12. And then we say, well, we only want to work 8 hours a day. And that's a redistribution of income, because that means we're working less and they have to pay us the same thing. So they bring in, you know, National Guard, cops, and private guards shoot us down, and finally we get 8 hours. Yeah, so it goes on like that. So I'm not a big fan of government. On the other hand, now we don't have those, what I would call convivial forms, where we can make it on our own. I don't know what the hell you make of all that. Well, you're thinking about it. All right, we can't have that, but thank you. I want to hear this. Let me just get this first. Jeff from Flat Rock is against legalizing drugs. How come?
Well, Pete, thanks for taking my call first. I work in a hospital, and I see narcotic drug addictions absolutely ruin people, ruin their lives, ruin their families.
I've seen that, too. Sure.
Right. And, you know, I heard just a couple comments about people enjoying drugs on their own time, sit back in their lazy boy like they're drinking a Pepsi, and do their drugs, and then life continues the next day. They get up and go to work. But these medications, they're basically medications, they're so physically and mentally addicting. A person just enjoy a certain drug at night and then just turn it off for the rest of the day. They're going to crave it. Well, you know, whether it's a pilot or, like you said, someone said a doctor or whatever.
Yeah.
You know, do you really want this person craving that drug?
Well, people,
you know, while they're taking care of people.
Well, of course not, and that would be absolutely unacceptable. Just like, the real problem drug in this society, of course, is alcohol, in which all the rest of them just pale beneath. If the others were legal and you had general access to it, would there be more problems? There very well could be, but the vast majority of people who use heroin, cocaine, crack, meth, all of that, do not get addicted and use it recreationally. The only drug that has almost 100% addictive powers is, you know that, Jeff, right?
Exactly.
Is nicotine. No, it's nicotine.
Oh, yeah.
No. I mean, hey, man, I had two drinks today. I had gin and tonic because I was pretending it was summer in the afternoon, and I had a glass of wine with dinner. But I certainly don't go much beyond that, and particularly not even having those together. But yeah, we know, I mean, who doesn't know that misuse of intoxicating substances creates all sorts of problems, and particularly in a society that seems so out of whack, people try to deal with their problems by overstimulating or depressing their feelings or what have you, and that winds up to the problems that you see. But nothing could be worse than this war on drugs. I mean, we've spent probably over $1 trillion on this this so-called war on drugs, and I always say the same thing, Jeff. I have no idea of where to get heroin or cocaine or methamphetamines. Actually, I have an idea where I get some marijuana, but I won't talk about that. But I'll bet you by that if I leave here at 2 a.m., I'll bet you by 5 a.m. I could have heroin. Don't you think?
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. So what does that say? It says that this war on drugs is similar to Bush's war on terror. I mean, it goes on forever, and it never has any successes, but is... this is another transfer of wealth. So, you know, we have the war on drugs creates clients for the prison industrial complex. It pays the salaries of tens of thousands of bureaucrats and cops and people like that that are involved in enforcement, where if we dealt with it as an emotional and physical problem, we'd spend a lot less money and probably have much greater results.
Mm-hmm. But I just think, you know, if it was legal, that's going to give the guy, he may have dabbled in some marijuana, but now cocaine is illegal. So he says, I'm going to try this. Doesn't realize the strength of this addictive drug where it can just physically, you know, get into his system and he's going to crave that. And it will just snowball. And
well,
then where does it end then?
I don't know how much it would go up, but I'll tell you, the social results of having drugs illegal, the fact that we have arrested, I don't even know what it is. I mean, it's like 1 million arrests a year just for marijuana, so that there's millions, maybe tens of millions of our fellow citizens and probably people we know that have been turned into criminals because either they wanted to self-medicate or usually, I mean, that's a small minority of people. Most people just like intoxication. That's why they have the second or third beer, because they like to get a buzz on. That's why they smoke marijuana. That's why they do a line of coke or smoke a pipe of crack or whatever, or do speed. They like the sensation. And it's okay to have, the legal drugs, like alcohol and nicotine, because the other stuff, it's the shadowy corporate interests that aren't official that are making the money off of it. Okay, thank you very much. I appreciate it. Where are we going next? All right, a little more. You know what I got to do? I got to do these commercials and be right back. Stay with us.
You're listening to WRIF.com.
Sex in your violence.
More Night Call on 101 WRIF Detroit. Here's Peter Werby.
All right, thank you very much. This is our final segment, then at 1 a.m. Eastern time, a couple of interviews that I previously recorded. One on urban sprawl. You know, that doesn't sound really exciting. But, hey, you know, we have to drive. We have to, in increasing distances, right, in order to get where we're going. So this fits right into at least a part of the discussion tonight. We've kind of started talking about legalization of drugs and polygamy. But I just wanted to give you kind of a war and peace report, because as we're talking about whether or not people should be allowed to get high or marry seven women, there's this war on terror. There's a war in Iraq, a war in Afghanistan. There's prisoners being held all around the world. There was just that trial in of Zacharias I can't pronounce his name. Moussaoui. Right. Yeah, Moussaoui. Sometimes I get in this stuff that when I don't hear these names. All right, never mind. That's whining. Here's a couple things that are going on. Torture widespread under U.S. custody. So we've become this torture state under George W. Bush. Another reason why we call it BCF, the Bush crime family. Torture and inhumane treatment are widespread in U.S.-run detention centers in Afghanistan, Iraq, Cuba, and elsewhere, despite Washington's denial. This according to Amnesty International. Evidence continues to emerge of widespread torture and other cruel, inhumane, or degrading treatment of detainees held in U.S. custody, according to this 47-page report. The U.S. government is not only failing to take steps to eradicate torture, it is actually creating a climate in which torture and other ill treatment can flourish. Now, there was this trial of Zacharias Moussaoui. And he was the guy that didn't get the death penalty because they decided that he was really a whack and didn't have anything that was the kind of involvement that he said he had. But apparently, a lot of people are making this point that the United States has two people in custody, Khalid Sheikh Mohammed and Ramzi Ben Al-Shib, who was Mohammed Atta's collaborator, and every step of the way, the financier, who was also in custody, Khalid bin Attash, I think, who helped plan this the attack on the World Trade Center. So why aren't these guys being charged? Well, the thing is that they were brutally tortured, and the United States does not want this to come out. So they get this freak trial of Moussaoui instead of being able to bring to justice the men that were behind this, that the Bush Co., the Bush crime family, the BCF, does not want exposed what methods they're using on people. Over in Iraq, get this, the gangster disciples, the Latin Kings, and the Vice Lords. You think, what the hell is this? These are gangs in Chicago. They're now in Iraq among the American soldiers. They are American soldiers. Gang graffiti is showing up 6,400 miles away in one of the world's most dangerous neighborhoods, Iraq. Armored vehicles, concrete barricades, and bathroom walls all have served as canvases for their spray-painted gang art at Camp Cedar 2, about 185 miles north of Baghdad. A guard shack was recently defaced with GDN for Gangster Disciple Nation, along with the gang's six-pointed star and the word Chi-Town. Jeffrey Stolson, an Army Reserve Sergeant in Iraq, is shown here pardon me, in front of a barricade tagged with gang graffiti in March in Iraq. Stolson, who has been in Iraq for almost a year, says he has taken hundreds of photos of gang graffiti there. Pardon me. So, how goes the fight? Well, you know that 10 Americans just died in a helicopter crash in southern Afghanistan. Well, according to the May 3rd New York Times, that the Taliban threat is said to grow in Afghan South, building on a winter campaign of suicide bombings and assassinations. And the knowledge that American troops are leaving, the Taliban appear to be moving their insurgency into a new phase, flooding the rural areas of the southern Afghanistan with weapons and men. So this destruction of the Taliban government, this attack on the government of Afghanistan, which was the Taliban, may have come to absolute nothing. Again, just one of these botched campaigns that these arrogant yet inept BCFers have put together. Each spring, with the arrival of warmer weather, the fighting season starts up, but the scale of militants' presence and their sheer brazenness have alarmed Afghans and foreign officials far more than in previous years. Remember, it took them a long time, the Afghans, to boot out the Russians, and it might be the same thing here. Now, one of the things we talk about, remember, always one of the themes that's going on here is a shift of wealth. I mean, how is wealth distributed in the United States? And when gas prices rise, this is a shift of wealth from us, the average person, up to the wealthy. But there's other ways as well, like this, the expenditure of $300 billion so far, and it's going to probably be triple that by the end that this misadventure, finally when it comes to an end, this illegal and unnecessary invasion and occupation of Iraq. So where's the money all going? Again, this takes our money that we work for, and it transfers it to weapons manufacturers and Halliburton and Bechtel and companies like that. Well, here's something from the London Times, and you got to wonder, why don't we ever see this in the United States? The article's called, In the Chaos of Iraq, One Project is on Target, a giant U.S. embassy. Now, remember, Bushco finally came around once they everything else had been pulled out from under them about weapons of mass destruction and connection to 9/11 and all that. So they were trying to free the Iraqi people. We're doing it in an extraordinarily odd way, of course. But we're dumping billions and billions and billions of dollars of our money. I don't mean the United States money. I mean your money and my money into, pardon me, rebuilding the country that Bushco destroyed unnecessarily. So here's this article. The question puzzles and enrages a city. This is Baghdad. How is it that the Americans cannot keep the electricity running in Baghdad for more than a couple of hours a day, yet still manage to build the biggest embassy on earth? So that's where our money's going, to build the largest U.S. embassy in the world in the middle of this war district that the United States says it has doesn't want to have a permanent presence. Irritation grows as residents deprived of air conditioning and running water 3 years after the U.S.-led invasion watch the massive U.S. embassy they call George W.'s Palace rising on the banks of the Tigris. In the pavement cafes, people moan that the structure is bigger than anything Saddam Hussein built. They're not impressed by the architect's claims that the diplomatic outpost will be visible from space and cover an area that is larger than the Vatican City and big enough to accommodate 4 Millennium domes. This is what we're paying for. Now, why is this? Why would the United States, what does Bush and Cheney see as necessitating this gargantuan structure other than what critics have said right from the beginning? This is going to be the main imperial oil outpost, and we're footing the bills for ExxonMobil and Bush and his pals. Now, where's the rest of this? They are more interested in knowing whether the U.S. State Department paid for the prime real estate or simply confiscated it. While families in the capital suffer electricity cuts, queue all day, line up all day to fuel their cars and wait for water pipes to be connected, the U.S. mission, due to open in June next year, will have its own power and water plants to cater for a population the size of a small town. We're going to be paying all these salaries. So anybody, there must be these residual Bush supporters. There's got to be a few of you out there. You might want to call in at 313-298-WRIF and tell me the justification for this. In a week when Washington revealed a startling list of missed deadlines and overspending on building projects, Congress was told that the bill for the embassy was $592 million. $592 million. So that's almost two-thirds of $1 billion is being spent to build the United States Embassy in Baghdad. Anybody want to tell me why that's okay? I mean, I'm curious. The heavily guarded 104-acre site, which will have a 15-foot-thick perimeter wall, has hundreds of workers swarming on scaffolding. Local residents are bitter that the Kuwaiti contractor has employed only foreign staff, because we don't trust our allies, and is busing them in from a temporary camp nearby. After roughing it in Saddam's abandoned palaces, diplomats should have every comfort in their new home. And keep thinking, every minute I'm reading this, we are paying for this. There will be impressive residences for the ambassador and his deputy, 6 apartments for senior officials, and 2 huge office blocks for 8,000 staff to work in. What in the world could the United States Embassy in Iraq need 8,000 office workers for? What in the hell is being planned there? This is even beyond what I can figure. Even planning for these permanent bases, even for the plan to loot the oil wealth of Iraq, why would the United States Embassy need 8,000 employees there? Let's see. There will be what is rumored to be the biggest swimming pool in Iraq, a state-of-the-art gymnasium, a cinema, restaurants offering delicacies from favorite U.S. food chains, because these, you know, they want to get their KFC and stuff like that, tennis courts, and a swish, whatever that means, American Club for evening functions. In the meantime, though, the U.S. Inspector General report into the Reconstruction Fund found that almost $22 billion had been spent. Water, sewage, and electricity infrastructure still operated at pre-war levels. Despite, quote, significant progress in recent months, less than half the water and electricity projects have never been completed. Only 6 of 150 planned health centers have been completed. U.S. officials spent $70 million on medical equipment for health clinics that are unlikely ever to be built. I mean, can you imagine? This is not a government either there or here. It's a racket. Remember I said earlier, I don't know if you were hearing, when I said that government originally began as a racket, well, now it's completely racketized. We are not ruled by a government. We are ruled by a racket that is simply involved in fleecing us from allowing us to work and shifting our money to their buddies and having these cockamamie schemes about world domination that always destroy empires. That always destroy empires. And this is it. The wealth, rather than being used to rebuild United States cities, like where is there any around here that might need a little rebuilding? I'm sure we can think of one, maybe that has. Let's see, oil production. Well, all of it just goes on and on and on. So, but he was saying, hey, we got to help these people. No one's called in with that in a long time. Maybe it's not even, you know, an issue anymore. But did you see that British military helicopter was hit by a missile on Saturday, shot down over this residential area? And these, and you're saying, oh, those Sunnis, they won't cooperate with the Shiites. Well, this was in a Shiite area in the Shiite south of Basra. And British soldiers with armored vehicles rushed to the site and were met by a hail of stones from a crowd of at least 250 people who jumped for joy and raised their fist as thick smoke rose from the wreckage. And so they were overjoyed that this had occurred. Let's see, the final thing. All right, our allies also are the Shiites. Oh, those Sunnis, those militants, those rebels, those, what do they call them, insurgents, whatever. Human rights groups have condemned the barbaric murder of a 14-year-old boy who, according to witnesses, was shot on his doorstep by Iraqi police for the apparent crime of being gay. Ahmed Khalil was shot at point-blank range after being accosted by men in police uniforms, according to his neighbors in the Al Dura area of Baghdad. K campaign groups have warned of a surge in homophobic killings by state security services and religious militias following an anti-gay and anti-lesbian fatwa issued by Iraq's most prominent Shia leader, Grand Ayatollah Ali al-Sistani. So this is our ally. This is our pal. This is what we're bleeding for. This is what we're killing Iraqis for. This is what we're destroying their nation. This is what our cash is going for instead of our homes and our families and our cities. These insane right-wing religious fundamentalists are declaring fatwas. That's where you say, kill them all. And this is our allies. This is George Bush's ally in Baghdad. Wow. Here's Brandon from Detroit. Brandon, hi. It's Peter Werbe. You're on the air.
How you doing, Peter?
Doing good, thanks.
Yeah, you had a thing you just said a minute ago, and I've been thinking about this for a long time. You stated about that embassy. What would be the reason why we built something so big, and why would it have so many office blocks and the swimming pool and the movie theaters and all that?
Yeah.
Well, I don't have any inside information, but I got a pretty good theory on that. I don't think Bush has any intent on ever leaving that country. And at the beginning of it, they were saying that it was going to be a few-year deal or whatever. And from the plans of the war and from how long it was taking them to do everything, they were talking it was going to be like 20 years. And being that you said that was like, what, $592 million or something
yeah.
over there?
Yeah.
That's ridiculous. They're putting pools and movie theaters and stuff. We're just going to take that country over. I mean, it's ridiculous that it's happening. But, you know, they need to pass some kind of an amendment to the Constitution for people like Bush. You know, his family's like multi-billionaires in the oil industry. He has too much power to be calling shots like that. You know, all he's doing is padding his own family's pocket.
Well, yeah.
You know, it's like a major conglomerate, you know, that the president of a conglomerate can, you know, didn't they break up trusts back in the 20s or something?
They did. Well, what we're talking about here is Bush Incorporated and Sons, right?
Yeah, yeah. I mean, their whole family. They're like oil tycoons. He should have never been, none of them should have ever been able to be elected into office. I mean, don't get me wrong. Somebody needed to go over there and do something about what Hussein was doing to all those people. I agree with that part. But for the way that they did it, and it's all just a big bunch of BS. You know, he lied his way into the country to get in there anyways, to get at the oil. That was the whole game plan.
Well, I think you're absolutely right, Brandon, about that they don't intend to leave. And people often are critical of Bush because they say he doesn't have an exit strategy. But it's just what you say. He doesn't have an exit strategy because they're not planning on exiting.
Yeah, he doesn't, and there's no plan on it. I believe it. Why do you think they keep running all the commercials on the TV, an Army of One, you know, Air Force, and all the Navy commercials, and Marines, the few, the proud? I mean, not to take anything away from our guys, but, I mean, all the people that are joining up for, they're just joining up to get shipped over there. We're just going to – I heard a rumor that we are going to ship, like, another 600 or 700,000 troops over there. Now, the only reason they would do that is so we could actually physically occupy that country. I don't think we have any intent on turning it over to them.
Well, the guy, the general, that before the war said there needed to be 300,000 or 400,000 people in order to secure it, Bush, particularly at the urging of Rumsfeld, just cashiered him out of there. All right, I got to end this segment of the show, so thank you so much, Brandon. I appreciate your call. Stay tuned for the interviews. I think you'll like them. Thanks for calling. We'll talk next week.
And now, a word from the Riff Legal Eagles. Unless otherwise stated, all entrants for WRIF contests must be at least 18 years of age and a legal resident of the United States. A household is eligible to win one contest per 30 days every 6 months for prizes valued at $600 or higher. Greater Media Detroit and its affiliates, promotional sponsors, advertising and promotional agencies, and other radio and television stations in the Detroit ADI are not eligible to participate. One entry per person. No purchase or other consideration is necessary to participate in the contest. Void where prohibited. Prizes are not transferable or redeemable for cash. 101 WRIF reserves the right to substitute any prize for one of equal or greater value. By participating in the contest, contestants consent to the broadcast and or publication of their name, voice, face, and or likeness without compensation. Participants listening online at www.wrif.com may receive audio that is delayed by as much as 60 seconds later than the over-the-air transmission, which could potentially affect chances of winning. General contest rules are available online at www.wrif.com or during regular business hours at the WRIF Studios, 1 Radio Plaza, Detroit, Michigan, 48220.
This is WRIF.com.
the plastic eyeballs. Spray paint the vegetables, dog food stalls with the beefcake pantyhose. Kill the headlights and put it in neutral. Stock car flaming with the Luger and the cruise control. Babies in Reno with the vitamin D. Got a couple of couches, sleep on the love seat. Someone keeps saying I'm insane to complain about a shotgun wedding and a stain on my shirt. Don't believe everything that you breathe. You get a parking violation and a maggot on your sleeve. So shave your face with some mace in the dark. Saving all your fruit stamps and burning down the trailer park. Yo. Cut it. So. Because one's got a weasel and other's got a flag. One's on the pole, shove the other in a bag. With the rerun shows and the cocaine doja. The daytime crap of the folk singer's club. He hung himself with a guitar string. A slab of turkey neck and it's hanging from a pigeon wing. If you can't write, if you can't relate, trade the cash for the beat, for the body, for the hate. And my time is a piece of wax falling on a termite. It's choking on the splinters.
Now, Night Call is back on 101 WRIF Detroit. Here's your host, Peter Werby.
Thank you very much for joining me. Probably a lot of you are in your cars right now, traveling immense distances, maybe to church, maybe to go golfing, maybe to go see relatives or friends or what have you. We take big rides for granted, don't we, here in the Detroit area. Things are getting a little dicey, though, with the price of gas. But the problem with how much we drive and the cost of gas is much greater than how it visits us individually. An interesting book has come my way, and we're fortunate enough to have the author with us. He's Anthony Flint, and his book is This Land, The Battle Over Sprawl and the Future of America. And Anthony Flint has been a journalist for 20 years, the last 16 at the Boston Globe, and he's had a lot of articles in magazines like Planning, Landscape Architecture, the Boston Globe Sunday Magazine, and he's a visiting scholar at Harvard, at the Harvard Graduate School of Design, and a research scholar at the Lincoln Institute of Land Policy in 2005. And it's wonderful that people are thinking about this because it's a problem. Anthony Flint, welcome to the Peter Werby Show.
Glad to be here.
Now, the battle over sprawl, now, that's nothing new. I mean, we've heard about sprawl and suburban and urban sprawl for, I don't know, ever since Levittown. I mean, what's new here?
Well, that was one of the things that interested me in doing research on the book, was that the smart growth movement and new urbanism and ideas about more sustainable development have been underway for 10 or 15 years. But at the same time, you've really had intensifying exurban sprawl in areas that are completely untethered, nowhere near any major city, just out there miles from anywhere. And so you've sort of got these two parallel tracks are going in different directions in the country today. What's new is the urgency surrounding land use in America today, and you do see it with the gas prices and higher energy prices overall, concerns about food security and sources of food, and all of those issues also including global warming, which is bearing down on us all, and of course a lot of our emissions come from the tailpipe. Each of us puts tons of carbon into the air every year, and about half of that is from driving everywhere. And we have to drive everywhere because our physical environment is so spread out.
Now, obviously, you care greatly about this, just from what I was describing at the beginning of the show of what you're involved in. But and don't hate me, but the battle over sprawl, I just get the feeling we've lost. I mean, it seems not only is it everywhere, but it also seems irrevocable. What do we do with people that, as I know, and I'm sure you know as well, that drive something like 80 to 100 miles round trip every day to go to work?
Well, I think there are more and more people who are getting a little bit fed up with that kind of round trip, and it's hitting them in the pocketbook quite a bit now with the gas well over $3 a gallon. And there is a subtle shift, I think, going on across the country where people are making an honest assessment of what their living needs are and how big a house they need and whether it's really as convenient as it seems to be when they move out into these far-flung subdivisions and have to drive everywhere, of course, to work, and then also just for errands, which are 80% of our car trips. So I think there's a lot more interest in living in a more urban setting or living in a town center setting in a suburban town, possibly near transit, or in a more compact or dense kind of development where you can walk to a few things.
Maybe, Anthony Flint, you could give us a little history, because I know 50 or 60 years ago, Detroit had 2 million people. There were this network of rail cars, and some of them even earlier went out to other cities, and a lot of buses, streetcars, people had neighborhood stores, and none of that now. In fact, a lot of suburbs don't even have sidewalks, and if the police see you walking, they'll actually want to know what you're doing.
That's right. Cities in America have had a bit of a tortured history. There, of course, have been some of the proudest moments in civilization are based in cities in Chicago or New York, San Francisco, and Detroit. It was a very livable place. The suburban development pattern really got going with intensity after World War II, of course, and a lot of factors were promoting it, the construction of the interstate system, subsidies and loans, the GI Bill, and through housing loans and policies, urban renewal in cities, which had an unintended negative effect, and it set the suburban nation on course through the 1950s. It's been a long, slow process to get back to more livable cities, and some places like Boston, San Francisco, New York, Chicago have had an easier time than others, like Cleveland or Detroit. But the bones of the livable city are there, unquestionably. The infrastructure is all there, the sewers, the water pipes, and the transportation system. So it's a long process of rediscovering what we have in our midst, which are these beautiful communities and not cities.
Well, certainly with Detroit, whose population is now about 850,000 at best, has this landmass, much of it uninhabited. Well, I shouldn't say uninhabited by people. They're great fields. I've observed that we're almost ready for farming again in some of the areas that the fields stretch for so far. And you could actually begin to redesign human-scale communities that didn't have some of the negative design features, or, you know, like just square block, you know, what are grid blocks and what have you. Although those had some features to it, right? I mean, every main street had like maybe three long residential blocks, and then at the end of each one in Detroit here, you would have stores that people could walk to. My mother-in-law never drove, and she, in Detroit, this isn't like New York, you understand this, but in Detroit, she walked up every day and got the food for dinner, walked back and cooked it.
Yes, and with the gas prices today, that's all the more important. And what you described, that's exactly the kind of urban walkable, the planners call it mixed use. That is, it's a mix of uses all jumbled together rather than the residential in one zone and then the commercial in a long car trip someplace else. The idea is to mix all of those uses together, and it's exactly what Detroit was with that corner store at the end of the block, and being able to walk for a half gallon of milk instead of jumping in the car has become a very valuable thing to be able to do today. There's another part of this, which is the public health dimension. There's been a lot of research on growing obesity and lack of physical activity. A lot of folks are discovering that walking just a little bit each day can do wonders for your health, and so that's part of it too. Again, it's just this kind of rediscovery and what planners and developers call infill development. It's happening in even a newer city like Denver, for example, where they're filling in the old Stapleton Airport and building housing and stores and creating an urban village on failed shopping malls, for example. A lot of potential to do exactly the same thing in Detroit.
Anthony Flint, your book is This Land, The Battle Over Sprawl and the Future of America. It's published by the Johns Hopkins Press. And I have actually one of these uncorrected proofs. Is it available yet in stores? Are we?
It is. It is out. Okay. It's shipping on Amazon and on its way to bookstores. And so it's very exciting.
That's good. Yes. And it is important to the point where the subtitle that says The Battle Over Sprawl and the Future of America. Is it that critical? I mean, are we facing, is sprawl that important that it could define either negatively or positively our future?
Well, you start with some population projections. Conservatively, we're going to add 100 million people to the country by 2050. Then you might throw in about 70 million baby boomers who are probably going to move around at least a little bit, looking for different places to retire. And then all of us who move as a matter of course, we're going to be moving into new development, about half of what exists today, according to the Brookings Institution. So we're going to be doing a lot of building. Now, if all of that is sprawl and most or all of those 100 million people move into sprawl, my prediction is that we will have a series of very dysfunctional metropolitan areas that are tied up in knots with traffic and paying a lot of money to get around, worsening pollution, but in a very practical sense, just spending a lot of money, and this is very important for local governments, which are going broke or having to raise taxes to pay for all that far-flung infrastructure that is the support system for sprawling development. So the prediction by some of the planners in the book is that we're really headed for a kind of a great national train wreck if we don't at least open up some different possibilities here and there for different kinds of development, different versions of the American dream.
Mm-hmm. Well, you are certainly putting out the clarion call on this, and that's what's needed. First is popular consciousness, and then financing through the institutions, private and public, that you mention. And it sure doesn't seem like in the Detroit area, and I don't know too much about other metropolitan areas, that there is any consciousness. You use the phrase Bloomberg, and maybe you can explain that. We talk about these new communities of McMansions that are the absolute opposite of what you're advocating in this land. So that's I mentioned a lot of stuff. Bloomberg's, the trend does not seem to be at this point to have a consciousness about the problem or solutions.
Well, if you keep your eye on those shifts, they're subtle shifts in the among the American consumer and home buyers. You know, so more than 70% of home buyers said that a shorter commute was the most important thing to them by in a survey done by the National Association of Realtors. People are finding that it's a lot more convenient, and they have a better sense of community living in a city or an older suburb. People are also finding that there are more opportunities for affordable housing in developments that are more compact and concentrated and have more multifamily housing, that is condominiums and apartments, rather than all these single-family homes spread out across the land in these Bloombergs, which, of course, you know, many of them are very large and 4,000 square feet and could be called McMansions, and that's not very affordable by you know, so many people in society. So smart growth is also seen as a more equitable way to provide shelter and livable communities for a greater range of families.
Anthony, if you put a little more stricter definition, if you would, on smart growth. You've mentioned it a couple of times, and I think it the implications of it are obvious, but it's with a capital S and a capital G, so this is like a movement.
It is. It doesn't have to be. It doesn't have to be capitalized. It's a funny term. It's sort of what the movement is stuck with in many ways. Of course, it makes it sound like if you're not behind it, then you're in favor of dumb growth, which isn't really the movement's intention at all. But it's really a set of policies that encourages redevelopment, that is, the reuse. It's almost like recycling for the land, building on empty parcels in the city close to infrastructure, and making that possible by changing zoning, providing funding for, say, brownfields cleanup, and taking other steps to reuse and redevelop the land, make the development more concentrated and compact and near transit whenever possible. All of this in contrast to the single-family subdivisions and strip malls and office parks that are more dispersed across the land and accessible only by car. So smart growth is really about providing a different style for living, providing some different choices, and really expanding the menu of choices that are available rather than only sprawl being predominantly available.
Anthony Flint, you talk some in your book, This Land, about Detroit and about race, and here we have maybe a prime area where, because I said there's so much of the housing stock is gone, so much you could reconfigure urban living to whatever genius could put its print upon it. But that both race plays a factor and racism, or and also racial perceptions. I just saw a guy the other day that was talking about Belle Isle, our island park in the Detroit River, and I mentioned something about playing handball there. He said, well, how can you go there without getting mugged? I said, when's the last time you were there? And he said, huh? You know, whenever anyone says, huh, you know, you got him. So he obviously probably hadn't been there in 20 years or something like that. But if you could speak a little about Detroit and race and how a lot of those factors, how we overcome those.
Well, I do have a whole chapter on how race and class factor into development patterns over time. And I start out by talking about Detroit and some of the excitement surrounding the Super Bowl and the stadiums and the downtown, but that it's got such a long way to sort of claw back to its former glory. And it's really held up as a prime example of how sprawl and suburban development and the investment of government funding into suburban infrastructure has really drained the life out of cities and had a disproportionate impact on people of color and low-income families, warehoused now in failing school systems in inner cities. And so more and more people have been connecting the dots on this and looking at how suburban development has been supported and funded through the funding of infrastructure, and now calling for a return of that investment in infrastructure to these cities and increasingly older suburbs. So in other words, it's not just Detroit these days, but it's that first ring of mature or older suburbs that are also really struggling. The same thing's going on in Cleveland, really struggling because the next ring of development has already gone 30 miles further away. So both the city and the older suburb are really in the same boat these days.
Mm-hmm. Now, the mayor of Detroit, Kwame Kilpatrick, is sort of the African-American du jour that a lot of suburban whites think it's okay to hate, that he's ruined Detroit. I mean, they all, you know, kind of progresses along during the years. Yet Detroit, over the for what, and I'm not any big supporter of this mayor, not, I don't even live in the city, but there has been more housing starts, beautification of downtown, as you mentioned, the Super Bowl. Lots of very positive things that have gone on, the reestablishment of a number of businesses there, but none of it really has the impact that the deindustrialization created in terms of a city now in debt. And I live in one of the inner ring suburbs, and I certainly would have no problem living inside the city of Detroit, except when you do you want to move to a city that's broke? Do you want to move to a city that has, you know, bad city services? So it's not even it's not a, I mean, a lot of people are, there's all these lofts opening and people like that, more adventurous than me, I guess. But you know what I'm saying, that there's got to be some fundamental solving of these major problems facing Detroit before you're going to have what's the opposite of exodus? I don't know.
An influx, sure. Well, okay, absolutely. Yeah. That's what's so fascinating and so very difficult about looking at development patterns and trying to change policies to bring about some different development patterns, or at least some alternatives to sprawl. And that is, if you try to put any restrictions on suburban development, which is often very affordable at the on the furthermost reaches of exurban sprawl, it tends to be sometimes very affordable homes. And if you put restrictions on that, and the cities are war zones and no one wants to live there, why, you've just increased the cost of housing overall. Some would argue that you won't really have smart growth and a return to cities until you solve the public education situation in this country, and that only by improving the public schools in cities like Detroit will you bring back the middle class, and not just the empty nesters and retiring baby boomers who want to be able to walk out of their loft and go out to dinner. So a lot of pieces have to come together, and there are a lot of moving targets, and it makes the policy making on this very, very challenging.
Yeah, and just in general, the availability of funds, we're in a period where a nation going in debt and what have you. But I suspect there are probably thousands of people that heard the beginning of this interview and in their car and are still listening because they're traveling somewhere, and they're probably thinking, yeah, hey, I'm living this. What can I do tomorrow? I mean, I don't like this. I wish I worked closer. I wish I could walk to work and play and school and what have you. That's tough. I mean, what can we do tomorrow?
Well, it really is a combination of individual choice and then some broader policy actions. And by the way, on the latter, smart growth really, I conclude, is a conservative idea. Ultimately, it saves money because you don't end up paying for infrastructure to be extended as far. It's a very efficient way to grow. What's really required is not, ultimately it'll save you money, and so you're not talking about a lot of funding. What you're talking about is changing zoning, which often forbids, dense, concentrated development. Doing things like that, changing your zoning so in a older suburb in your town center, you can have mixed use development, which might now be forbidden. So it's changing the rules of the development game that really is the most important thing to do, and people can support that by at the ballot box, at public hearings where infill development is proposed, and then they can take they can make an honest assessment of their own living needs and reconfigure as necessary. Maybe it wasn't the best decision to get the house as affordable as it may have seemed at the time, so far out in the subdivision. And maybe folks don't need every corner of that 4,000-square-foot house and could and can sort of do a little personal makeover on their own living needs. So that's an action that you can take today.
And it does involve, as you're indicating, that if the, you want to have some say in the way the world's going to be in the future for yourselves and your children, that you have to get involved. If you're just going to kind of hang out and hope, and just hope that it's done for you, maybe it will, maybe it won't. But most change in this country has come about through mass citizen involvement. And I think we are getting tired of this all. I mean, one of the things you said about personal change, I know that I worked, about 15 to 18 minutes away from my house, and then the radio station here moved. Now it's 4 minutes away. But it sometimes there's like these factors you can't even control, obviously. But many you can. Let me ask you this. Is there a website? I do have the website for the Johns Hopkins University Press, which is jhupbooks.com. Do you have one for the book itself?
Yeah, sure. It's pretty easy to remember. It's www.anthonyflint, that's F-L-I-N-T, like Flint, Michigan, .net.
That's good enough.
anthonyflint.net.
Yeah, and I'll have this on my website, and I want to thank you so much for taking the time to talk about the battle over sprawl and the future of America. That's the subtitle. The title of the book is This Land. Anthony Flint has been my guest on the Peter Werbe Show. Thanks so much for being with me.
Thank you.
Got a buck? Get a song.
Can I get a holla holla?
Log on to WRIF.com and check out the digital music store. Any riff song is available for just 99 cents online. Browse by artist, title, or riff playlist. Easy and cheap. The Riff Digital Music Store at WRIF.com. Everything.
Get into it.
That rocks. Rocks. Rocks.
You're listening to WRIF.com.
Just where you lay down, dragging waters till the depths give up their dead. What did you expect to find? Was there something you left behind? Don't you remember anything I said when I said jump on? Don't fall away and leave the bleeding in my hands again. Leave the bleeding in my hands, love is bleeding.
More Night Call on 101 WRIF Detroit. Here's Peter Werby.
Thank you very much for joining me. The stories of civil rights are embedded properly in our historic and social memory, and well, that we should. It was an important segment in the development of this country. It's a story that that certainly hasn't been finished, but its origins in the 1950s, or its official origins in the 1950s, with things like the Montgomery bus boycott and what have you, are part of American legend. And we're told this is what has made America more democratic. There was a very important book came out in 1988. It chronicled the murder of James Cheney, Andrew Goodman, and Michael Schwerner, the three young men who went south in 1964 to assist in voter registration and civil rights efforts there. For the efforts that they put out, they were murdered. And the book We Are Not Afraid was a New York Times notable book in that year, and it's been reissued by Nation Books. It's the work of Seth Kagan and Philip Dre. Philip Dre is the author also of At the Hands of Persons Unknown, The Lynching of Black America. That won a 2002 Robert Kennedy Book Award and the Southern Book Critics Circle Award for nonfiction. Now, the book's just been released, and joining us from New York City is co-author Philip Dre. Welcome to the Peter Werby Show.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Why is a wonderful book, but 1988? Now, this is 2006. This is 18 years ago. What motivated you and Nation Books to want to bring it out again?
Well, of course, it's, you know, any book about race relations in America is always sort of timeless. This book, of course, has been relevant recently, as a lot of people know, because just last year, the state of Mississippi finally convicted somebody of murder in this case. You know, this was in its day in 1964 when these murders occurred. It was a huge national story, and nobody really could figure out who had murdered these boys. And the state of Mississippi claimed that it was a hoax. They refused to investigate, so the FBI had to come in to sort of look into the matter. And it was only last year that finally a man, Edgar Ray Killen, was convicted in Mississippi of having conspired to murder Goodman, Schwerner, and Cheney.
Now, the perpetrators were law enforcement officers of the county down there. It was Neshoba County, if I remember right. In fact, looking through your wonderful book, We Are Not Afraid, and looking at the men accused of it, Neshoba County Sheriff Lawrence Rainey and Deputy Cecil Ray Price, it's like you went to Hollywood Central Casting and said, I need some guys that as soon as you see them on screen look like racists who will commit violence.
No, that's a very good point. You know, and there are pictures in the book of not only the police, but also some of the members of the lynch mob. And you're right, they look like you could not have ordered up these characters. I mean, they look like you would definitely cross the street if you saw them coming. You know, it's interesting, though, the interesting point you make is that the summer that the boys disappeared, Life magazine ran a big double-page photograph of all of the men who were indicted by the federal government, and that included both police and Ku Klux Klansmen. And that photograph appeared in Life magazine, and it really kind of shocked America, because a lot of Americans didn't really know anything about lynching. And the idea that the police would be involved in cahoots with the Ku Klux Klan to murder three young civil rights workers really caught people by surprise. It just kind of blew them away. And that photograph of these smug, like these 21 guys, you know, sitting there looking like really hoods, basically, even though they were wearing police uniforms, really sent a shock through America and helped to sort of, you know, galvanize concern about the case.
And Sheriff Rainey had this permanent smirk on his face.
Oh, yeah. Well, that's because they were super confident. They were confident that nothing would happen to them.
And that confidence was borne out.
And it really was, in a way. Of course, you know, the federal government, this was the first time the federal government since Reconstruction had actually won a conviction in a lynching. And so their smugness was taken away a bit when some of them were sent to prison for civil rights conspiracy. But in terms of the state of Mississippi charging them with murder, they were right. That never happened just until last year.
Mm-hmm. Now, was my memory, I'm not all the way through your book, We Are Not Afraid, and mm-hmm. my memory is failing me. What were any of the law enforcement officers found guilty?
Just one, Cecil Ray Price, the deputy sheriff, who was very much involved, and he was the one who, you know, this was a very traditional kind of Southern lynching in a way. The policeman detained Goodman, Turner, and Cheney on a trumped-up speeding charge. He put them in jail until the mob could get organized, and only then, after dark, released the boys and told them to go on home. Well, of course, they just went right into the hands of the mob, and Price himself was involved in like rearresting the boys and sort of turning them over to the Klan. So he was very culpable. Rainey had an alibi. He was like out of town or something, and so it was harder to pin it on him. But yes, you're right. They did get, of the 21 who originally indicted, 7 went to federal prison.
Mm-hmm. Now, Goodman, Schwerner, and Cheney are such icons of martyrdom, and as well they should be for the civil rights struggle. But it just struck me, Philip Dre, when you said the boys, and they actually were flesh and blood human beings. And how old were they?
Well, Mickey Schwerner was sort of the leader. He was 24. James Cheney was a black man from Meridian, Mississippi, who was 21, and Andy Goodman was only 20 years old, and he was spending his first day in Mississippi, the day that they were abducted and killed.
Oh, boy.
So these were very young guys. But, of course, that was typical. That was the amazing thing about the civil rights movement at that time. It was they called it the Mississippi Summer Project. They reached into the northern states, like Michigan, Ohio, Massachusetts, invited young people to come down to Mississippi to try to work on voter registration and this kind of thing. So a lot of very, very young people, 19, 20, 21 years old, were involved. And, of course, it took a lot of commitment and real courage of anyone who can imagine, traveling in a state like Mississippi in the 1960s, where there was a lot of open hostility toward anybody who was an outsider, let alone a civil rights worker. It took real courage.
Now, the title of your book, We Are Not Afraid, almost has a ring of irony, given what happened to the three of them. And the first line of your book says, on the evening of June 16, 1964, a gang of armed white men appeared at the Mount Zion Methodist Church in an all-black community of Longdale,
right,
Mississippi. So there was great reasons to be afraid.
Oh, absolutely. And that, of course, that's the sort of the beautiful thing about the story. And it's still amazing to me, that you had not only these young northern college students coming down, but, of course, not to mention the black people in Mississippi themselves were incredibly courageous. They were in a way much more vulnerable because they couldn't go home. They couldn't get on a plane and go back to Detroit or New York or Cleveland or wherever. They had to stay down there. And yes, it was extremely dangerous, and a lot of people were hurt or put in prison, that kind of thing.
The book is We Are Not Afraid. I'm speaking with its co-author, Philip Dre. It's been re-released as a nation book. It originally appeared in 1988. And, sort of the preface, you say that you received a lot of help from the families of Goodman, Schwerner, and Cheney. Were they anxious to have the story told? Because it had been told considerable number of times before, but never in such detail, and not so much wrapping it up as with also the subtitle here, the Civil Rights Campaign for Mississippi.
Right. Well, our book differed from others that had preceded it in that we focused on the story of the young people involved. In other words, who were these people? In a way, that's sort of how we got into the story. We were personally intrigued, like, what on earth? Because, we wrote this book in the height of the Reagan era when everybody was kind of into, like, the sort of the me generation. And we would sort of sit around, and my co-author and I, and think, what would make a 20-year-old person quit college and go to Mississippi and risk their lives for some kind of principle like this? And really, that question kind of led us to meet this entire generation of these civil rights workers like Andy Goodman, James Cheney, and Mickey Schwerner, who were doing just that. So, it's the kind of thing where you just have to kind of look back. It's sort of hard to put yourself in that era, but that early romantic phase of the civil rights movement was really an incredible time of sort of moral commitment in America.
Well, I asked also about their families and their cooperation with you. So it's like 20 years or more after the murder of their children. And what was their state of mind, and what was their were they and their story had been told. Yet they were
right. Well, of course, it was the kind of thing, you know, you can imagine in a way that they felt. Their reactions varied, to tell you the truth. Carolyn Goodman, who was Andy Goodman's mom, was, and still is to this day, very active in the story. In other words, she has always believed that just as her son went to Mississippi for this for this reason, that it's her duty to kind of carry on with it and to publicize it. And to publicize what happened to him. The Schwerner family was somewhat less enthusiastic about it. They felt that the story of Southern civil rights really belonged to Black Americans. And that what had happened to Goodman, Schwerner, and Cheney, all the attention their case got, really had to do with the fact that two of the victims were white.
Which was true.
There's a great deal of truth to that.
Sure.
And that's been true throughout American history. Whenever white people are lynched, it's usually a much bigger case than when it happens to an African American. And so they were right about that. The Cheney family was sort of somewhere in the middle. They were still very, very bitter. They felt angry. The rest of the family had been forced to leave Mississippi because of death threats they'd received. In other words, after James disappeared, it was very uncomfortable for the extended Cheney family to remain there. So they were still very, very angry and were willing to cooperate with us, but were not, again, they were somewhat less enthusiastic just because the whole subject to them is such a raw one.
Mm-hmm. Well, Philip Dre, your book from 2002, At the Hands of Persons Unknown, The Lynching of Black America, so you know this dreadful period in American history when black people were terrorized by the white community. But is this unusual? This was a really political assassination. Much of the other, and I'm talking off the top of my head here.
No.
Tell me if I'm correct. It was to keep the African American population in line socially and economically. But here was a blatant political assassination.
You're absolutely right. Although the truth is, lynching historically there were always a lot of gray areas. In other words, people were lynched for being successful businessmen. They were lynched because someone's girlfriend had a crush on them, or they had offended a white person in some way. And they could be lynched for political reasons too, of course, way back into Reconstruction. You know, if you asserted yourself politically, even if you were like a white northerner down in the South, you were sort of looking for trouble, and a lynch mob might be looking for you. So it wasn't historically that uncommon. But you're right, absolutely. The Klan in Mississippi was very hostile to the civil rights movement and really determined to make an example of somebody. And they hated Mickey Schwerner. They called him Goatee. He wore a little beatnik goatee. And they just thought of him as being sort of like, he was like a Bolshevik he was like the Antichrist to them, kind of. He set up shop in Meridian, Mississippi, and just bugged the hell out of the local whites and the Klan. And so they set out to eliminate him. And Cheney and Goodman were sort of guilty by association as far as the Klan was concerned.
We think now of the racism that marked so much of American history, and unfortunately some of it still exists, as pathological in nature. Yet it is the bulwark for excluding an enormous number of people from the economic and political sphere. Were the people like the Klan and the Sheriff Rainey and them in Mississippi in 1964, were they fully aware that they were defending an economic and social order, or were they just acting off this racial madness, or both?
I think in their minds they were doing the former, like you said. I think they were, you know, Mississippi was very proud of itself in that it was the last southern state to not capitulate to the influence of the civil rights movement. They called it Fortress Mississippi. And of course, it wasn't just the Klan, but you had this all the way up through the governor, the state's leading newspaper. They all were sort of reading from the same page. They were not saying, let's calm down and like get along with this transformation. They were saying, no, let's dig in our heels. We're going to fight. You know, they're not going to make this into Kennedy's Hungary. And, you know, the rhetoric was very strong and vituperative. And so the Klan, in a way, were sort of just like the foot soldiers for really this kind of like monolithic kind of resistance that Mississippi, they called it Mississippi the Closed Society, represented at that time.
Well, they were in a very twisted way onto something. I mean, there was just a certain amount of political power and wealth to go around, and if you could exclude a whole section of the population from competing with that. It left, you know, only the goodies for those that had the dominant position, because very correctly now African Americans are well integrated into Southern society and culture, and mm-hmm. they occupy the positions that you know, that previously they were excluded from.
Well, I think part of the problem in Mississippi always has been the fact that blacks are actually the majority. You know, in other words, you see that in places like South Carolina, too. States that actually have a black majority.
Is that right?
The whites actually get even, they sort of tend to get more agitated, because to them the idea of their opinion being, of themselves being sort of obliterated or overruled by a black majority, historically has kind of haunted them. And that was very true in Reconstruction. You know, those states were, that's where a lot of violence took place during the 1870s as well, because the whites were fearful that the freed slaves, now that they could vote and all this, and that they were political actors, would represent the kind of, they would become like the ruling class. And it was always kind of a half-baked idea, but it was enough to really scare a lot of white people. And I think that idea kind of has remained alive in Mississippi even into the mid-20th century.
Philip Dre is my guest on the Peter Werby Show. He's the co-author of We Are Not Afraid, the story of Goodman, Schwerner, and Cheney and the Civil Rights Campaign for Mississippi. It's a Nation Books reissue of the 1988 telling of the story of the murder of the three civil rights workers. We're in Mississippi at that time. I think books like this are so important because we all know the broad, I hope we all know, but I think it's taught in schools now, the broad outline of it. You know, blacks were excluded, they couldn't, had the mm-hmm. separate bathrooms, and they couldn't get jobs, and they couldn't vote, and then heroic people took action and altered the situation, although with a lot of casualties along the way.
Well, of course, you know, the ultimate story, of course, this goes back to what you asked me about the title of the book, We Are Not Afraid. I mean, ultimately, Goodman and Schwerner and Cheney won. In other words, the civil rights movement won the battle in Mississippi ultimately, even though, yes, there were casualties. But the remarkable thing about the civil rights movement was it was basically a nonviolent movement, and it completely dispelled the old system in Mississippi. It was like the old feudal society in Mississippi was completely brought down by the civil rights movement. And the Goodman, Schwerner, and Cheney case was a sort of a pivotal moment, because what that did is it brought the attention of the nation and the federal government and the FBI onto Mississippi in a way it had never been brought before. And even Lyndon Johnson himself, who was then the president, you know, Kennedy had only been assassinated a few months before this. And Johnson, you know, he was very sensitive about lawlessness. And when he heard about this incident, he said, we're not going to have this. The Klan is not going to run amok down in Mississippi. And he sent the FBI in there like full force. I mean, it was intense. And he said, don't come back until you crush the Klan, basically. And so that was sort of the importance of the Goodman, Schwerner, and Cheney case. It sort of turned the tide. It turned the nation against Mississippi. And they said, you've got to come into the modern age with us, folks, you know, basically. So it's an extremely important case in that regard.
In some of the publicity, where am I? Did I say it? Oh, yeah. It said, when the book originally appeared in the late 1980s, it was touted as a corrective to the more sensationalized treatment of the same story in the film Mississippi Burning. That film came out in the 80s? Man, time is flying, if that's the case.
Yes, that's true. Mississippi Burning, I believe, came out in 89.
Ooh.
Late 88 or 89.
What'd you think of the film?
Well, it's interesting. The film, you know, it's a very graphic film. It's based on truth. In other words, the two characters, the local FBI man and the federal man from Washington, those are based on real characters who appear in our book. The story gets twisted a bit in the movie. In other words, there's, you know, various, like, weird, just a kind of a sex angle, I believe, and at one point they have like a black FBI agent, which is a completely insane idea. There were none in 1965 or whenever it was. It kind of distorts it. And of course, the reason a lot of people dislike that movie was because it made it appear that the FBI, in a way, were the heroes of the civil rights movement. And of course, a lot of people resented that at the time when it came out, because the FBI, they were sort of Johnny's come lately. I mean, yes, they did come down and sort of do what they should have been doing, like, you know, 10 or 20 years earlier. But in the trenches all that time in Mississippi had been the black civil rights workers, and then later the white civil rights workers who joined them. So there was a little bit of, there was always a bit of resentment against the federal government. And so I think people, that's why they didn't like that film so much. They felt like it sort of made the civil rights workers themselves sort of secondary.
Tell me a little about the nonviolence of not only Cheney, Goodman, and Schwerner, but the whole civil rights movement, because you mentioned before that of their commitment to nonviolence, except there were pockets. I mean, if we go back more into the 50s, Robert Williams in North
yep.
Carolina, there were the, I forget, what was it, Deacons for Justice and Defense or something like that. And then and the Black Panthers of Alabama, from which the Oakland, California Panthers took their lead. So there were little pockets of people that said, hey, we remember back to the populist movement of the late 1890s, and we're going to deal with armed resistance. But that was so small that I suspect probably a lot of people are hearing this for the first time. They thought it was all nonviolent.
Yes, that's true. Those are interesting examples you mentioned. There were some, like someone like Robert Williams. I mean, he was someone who, you know, basically said, let's meet violence with violence, and threatened to lynch the police and this kind of thing. You know, he was a really interesting character, but he was very exceptional. I mean, he was only one person and his followers, but, you know, if you're talking about the civil rights movement broadly, you're talking about thousands of people, not just people who actually went to the South, but people all over the country who supported it, you know, who had meetings, who sent in money. It was a huge, huge cause. And, of course, you know, Martin Luther King was really the figurehead of it. But when you consider all that was accomplished, and the fact that it was largely accomplished nonviolently through sit-ins, marches, protests, advocacy, appeals to authority, that sort of thing. They were largely peaceful. Most of the violence came from the other side, from the Klan.
Well, I would say probably 99% of it.
Exactly.
Yeah. Well, I mean, the reason I brought it up in just you know, sort of the footnotes is that they would seem, the people that said you know, self-defense is justified, they would seem more in keeping with the American tradition, which is replete with you know, armed exchanges of, you know, you go back to the abolitionist movement and John Brown and all that. Yet they were, it's amazing that a whole movement was marked by the philosophy in many ways of one man.
Well, you know, it's very interesting, of course, about nonviolence is that it will work for a certain period of time, but then people get impatient with it. And as you know, by the mid-1960s, late 60s, the whole nonviolent thing was getting, people were sort of straining at the bit a little bit. You know, that's when you had the whole Black Power movement. People who had been in the movement down south were getting fed up. They didn't like being beaten up and just turning the other cheek after a while. So I mean, Martin Luther King, I mean, the civil rights movement was very successful, but the nonviolent aspect of it began to kind of fray after a number of years because people just simply will not allow themselves to be hit over the head too many times before they start saying, well, I don't know about this.
Yeah, and he had Malcolm X beginning to
That's right.
be critical. I mean, he has a famous statement. He says, be nonviolent whenever you meet up with nonviolence.
Right. Well, of course, you know, that's been a constant sort of tug of war throughout American history among African Americans, is, you know, resistance or, you know, nonviolent resistance. And obviously you can sort of make arguments for either one. I mean, you know, isn't Nat Turner a hero? You know, a lot of people would say he was. But, you know, then again, in terms of actually, you know, this was an argument in the 19th century as well, for instance, after the Civil War in Reconstruction, like, well, how are we going to actually get somewhere? Would it be better to be sort of peaceful and petition Congress and do all these kind of nice things or pick up a gun? And of course, you know, because of the fact that African Americans traditionally have been outnumbered, you know, it's always seemed sort of questionable, the whole idea of like armed resistance kind of thing.
Yeah, if only as a tactic, I guess for some people it was a tactic, other people it was a commitment to a philosophy, but ultimately it worked. It did open the consciousness and the conscience of the dominant society.
Oh, absolutely, and you make a very good point in that it was, you know, for some people it was a real belief, it was a real faith. They thought, I'm a nonviolent person, and this is how I'm going to get things done. For other people, it was a tactic. They thought, this is the way we're going to get this done. But you're absolutely right. The effects of it were incredible. And, of course, anyone who lives through that period remembers how inspiring those kind of marches and rallies, and a lot of those people, too. Martin Luther King was just one of many people, you know, really inspiring figures. And, yes, it's right. They amazing in a way how much they accomplished really just by through principle, really, nonviolent principle.
And here we are today, and further to go to make this society colorblind and democratic. But books like this are just an incredible look back at the past to give us an idea of what we can do as citizens. Because remember, it was citizens acting outside of the formal structures of government that really brought about this change and made government move. The book is We Are Not Afraid. It's by Seth Kagan and Philip Dre. Philip Dre has been my guest. Philip, is there a website I can send people to?
You know, they should just go to the Nation Books, just like nationbooks.com.
Okay, and I'll have that on my website, peterwerby.com.
And, of course, also, I think Amazon, I'm sure Amazon is carrying the book as well.
Thank you so much for being my guest.
Thanks, Peter.
This is WRIF.com.
rocks with Shinedown. Here's I Dare You on 101 WRIF Detroit.